Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Beth. Well, I'm glad to be in my air-conditioned office. It was much worse out in Tampa than it is here.
It was really bad here last night. It's a little better this morning. I have a crazy video of the smoke. I was actually texting Scott last night because he lives right down the street from me. This is worse smoke than I have ever seen anywhere. And the only thing I feel like I can compare it to is when I was in Missoula several years ago, and there was a big fire happening out like Lolo area, which is, you know, it's probably 10 miles away, maybe. I mean, we were like driving into canyons that had fires in them, and the smoke was maybe this bad. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it is. If it's as bad again tonight as it was last night, Donna and I are going to go out and sleep in the living quarters of her horse trailer because there's an air conditioner in there.
Yeah, I know. That's the crazy thing. All of us rely on keeping our windows open. You know, none of us have air conditioners. And so, yeah, we slept with all the windows closed. It was all right last night. We'll see how it goes. Our bedroom is top floor, though. But we have a bed down here in the basement. So if it gets really bad, we'll just come down here, I guess.
And apparently I'm told these masks don't do any good for smoke.
I don't actually think that's true. Scott is in our waiting room. He could probably tell us the answer to that.
Yeah, and, you know, I was outside about 10 o'clock last night doing some stuff, and I had my headlamp on, and it looked like it was snowing.
I heard that from some people that they saw some.
Yeah, I mean, it's really obvious when you're wearing a headlamp and it's dark. And it was like, wow, I'm breathing all that stuff.
Scott, are masks good for particulate matter? Do you know?
For sure. I mean, those are larger particles than what we're seeing with the COVID. So certainly they can help.
Oh, okay. Well, I hope so because I was wearing it last night.
I wore mine to take my dog for a walk. I felt better. I'll say that.
Yeah.
There's only one other time I can think of where it might have been as bad as when we had a bunch of smog or smoke coming in from the west. And then we had that local fire. But we didn't have any way to measure it at that point. So at least now we have those monitors and we can gauge, you know, where we're at and then also see nearby and regionally what's going on. So I think that's been a big help.
Yeah. Well, I know you'll talk about it more actually in the Board of Health meeting. We're just sort of chit-chatting about how awful things are outside.
Yeah, I had just a bunch of ash on the car this morning that as soon as you get going, you can see it kind of blow off the hood. And so yeah, pretty bad.
Is smoke one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse? Or no.
That and blue green algae.
Yeah. No, it's fires, floods, famine, and pestilence. We've got the pestilence going, and we've got the fire going. We don't have famine yet. So.
Thank God.
Yeah, that's
not say yet, Tim. Good Lord.
I'm a pessimistic sort, that's for sure.
Well, I said, did you see that there is algae on, where is it, Steamboat Lake? Is that
Stage,
what you
Stage Lake.
Stagecoach, okay.
That's an ongoing problem. That's because of Doug and that upper Yampa water building that stupid reservoir there. It never would have happened without that reservoir.
So the article in the paper was Steamboat Lake. They
oh, it was?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, it was Steamboat Lake. That they've said you're not supposed to be going swimming in there and then also not have your dogs in there because of the algae.
So that
that's
one's not Doug's fault?
I've never heard about that in Steamboat Lake.
That one's not Doug's fault, or that one is Doug's
fault? No, apparently not. Although
not my fault, no.
But they
I think it probably is. We just need to make the connection. We just haven't made the connection.
There you go.
Well, they have the same issue at Stagecoach from time to time. So.
Yeah, I knew that.
And I need to get updates on that study, that nutrient study from Stagecoach, because that was related two algal blooms. So hopefully that'll help inform what's going on in Steamboat Lake also.
You know, the funny thing is my recollection of what I've heard, the first year that thing was filled, it had algae bloom. So it's hard to figure out exactly how that got, you know, so I don't know, you know, hopefully, like you say, Scott, hopefully they'll be able to help us and figure out if there's anything we can help it and do it better. So.
Well, and it's a different type that produces these toxins. So, but yeah, hopefully that study will help inform Steamboat Lake also.
Is that tied directly to water temperature?
Well, that's part of what the study is doing, is there's probably multiple reasons. And I think I've explained it in the past as kind of like looking at pieces of a pie, and temperature is a piece of the pie, and geology and land practices. And the idea is to find out what are the pieces of the pie and how big are they? So hopefully it can inform corrective measures or management or something. We'll see.
Try to figure that it's not the ranchers fertilizing up there that's helping with the situation as well. So responsible management of fertilizer.
That may be one of the pieces of the pie. We just don't know how big.
Or even our pea bird. Yeah, so.
Careful, huh?
I know.
Scott, do you get involved in that? Or because it's in a state park, are you not involved? Who's responsible for that?
So I'm involved because we initiated that through that watershed, Upper Yampa Watershed Group. And Lynn Halliday is still heading up that group, although with COVID, things have sort of slowed down.
Yeah.
And so I'm a part of that group and was helping to make those decisions about what to do. But Lynn was the primary mover for getting that study done. And so that should be very close. So hopefully I'll talk to her pretty soon, and hopefully we'll have something ready to go and meet in front of the Board of Health or the BCC to talk about it.
What about like the Steamboat Lake situation though? Like, are you involved in those at all or not really?
Well, not directly, but certainly that's a function of that watershed group. That's something that they could take on if we wanted to, you know, do a study or use some of the resources that we've had from past efforts to help inform that. And like I said, it's the first time I've seen it up there or heard about it, the blue-green algae.
Yeah.
And so it'll be interesting to have a conversation with that group. And that includes Andy Rossi, Liz Schnackenberg, people from the NRCS, and some other folks. So
I assume who made the call on that? I didn't read the article. I just saw the headline. So who actually made the call on it, you think?
You mean as far as to put out an alert for people?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was probably the state park.
Okay, great. Well, that's good.
All right, well, we're doing our usual good job of just bouncing around aimlessly during our work session. I mean, let me attempt to reel it in just a little bit. Mark, do you have any updates for us this morning? Nope.
He's gone.
Well, apparently not.
Tim, I'm sorry. I clicked the wrong button. Tim, we, in the course of our public health discussion this morning, we anticipate a discussion about staff hiring within public health. And because I know that's coming up shortly, what we'll do is maybe wait until Roberta's on and Dr. Harrington has participated in some of the interviews and discussions we've had so far. I know you got a very helpful note from Beth in the last 24 hours about one key position. So we'll be prepared with that information to make some recommendations to you. But just to know that that's a very important part of our conversation this morning in regard to public health, is some of the staffing that we still anticipate going forward. only other item that is again COVID related, because again, back to public health, is we continue to move forward on the staff space needs. And we work, all the wheels are in motion, and everything appears as if we're gonna still be able to target that last week in August to be able to have the move complete and to have public health in that new space. So that's good news. That's all I have, Tim, right now.
So the definitely some of the good news with that is that'll give Dan an opportunity to take another look at that COVID-19 CARES money budget. We've just identified some savings out of that budget.
We have indeed. And as a matter of fact, we had Dan and I run a budget call yesterday afternoon, and we were specifically identifying what we need to track going into fiscal year 21. But really the only CARES money or CARES related money that we're going to be tracking into fiscal year 21 will be the CDPHE money coming forward, the $438,000. As you know, we're going to have the FEMA declaration will be concluded within fiscal year 20. And also the monies that we have gotten through the CARES Act funding, the approximately $1.2 million, will also need to be expended in this fiscal year. Now, we may have some reimbursables that will stretch into maybe January and February, but you know, under an accrual accounting method, that would still apply to the fiscal year 20, as far as that's concerned. But we're certainly paying close attention to it. But to your point, Tim, absolutely, that will represent some savings to us in terms of what we thought was going to be some of those expenditures.
And it's probably premature to start thinking about how we would spend that money, but at some point, certainly, and I guess we can rely upon our end of September look at where we're at, and then, you know, if we have $100,000 or $200,000 left over, then we could start thinking about some community-related efforts that we could undertake to spend that money, and then come up. I don't know if we need to work out a set of criteria for, say, businesses or nonprofits that might be interested in applying for some of that money. I hate to get anybody's hopes up, because it's just as likely that money's going to evaporate anyway. But again, we don't want to be caught flat-footed at the end of the year not having injected some of that money into our local economy.
Wasn't that the purpose of that October
time?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously at that point, we will just have to make the best projections we can. But yeah. I agree with you. We need to make sure all that money gets spent locally and we don't have to send any of it back, especially because we can use it to support
And I think if on October 1st we're really convinced that that bucket of money exists, it shouldn't take us that long to come up with a set of criteria for community organizations or businesses that might want to apply for some of it.
Just as a one thought on that, I don't know if this makes sense. I sent you guys the information that John Bristol had sent me about what he was looking at in terms of a low interest loan fund. But if you look at some of those other municipalities or locations within the state, some of them are grant funds through that exact same program. So I don't know if that's a place to start. And again, like you said, I think we need to wait and see. We don't want to promise anything we're not able to deliver. But in terms of starting to think about what the infrastructure of something like that might look like, it might just be worth looking at how some of those other communities have done this, which there were some links there that kind of showed what that looks like.
Right.
Well, the loan concept is still problematic.
Yeah, no, but my point, I agree with you. My point was that some of those were not loan funds. They were grant funds that some of the other communities were doing that were examples on that website.
I also, we should, and I don't, you know, I don't know where we're at with PPE and test supplies, but certainly stockpiling PPE and test supplies and buying it before the end of the year would be appropriate for use in 2021.
So I would be careful of using the word stockpiling because I think there are people trying to prevent us from doing that.
Yeah, I guess, you know, my thought about, and I signed off here for a second. I didn't get to hear Beth's comments. I didn't sign off. My internet signed me off. But, you know, I'd be a little bit leery about worrying about spending the money in December from where we're at.
Yeah. It's probably going to be all gone anyway. I get it.
And again, I'm sure we can run that money out the door in a heartbeat, just like it. So I guess, you know, the other thing too, and I, Beth, you said this morning at the recovery call, the team call, so that you're meeting with Mo and to work on this protect our neighbors thing. So, and again, I think we talked about it a couple of days ago. I think we kind of still maybe need to have some outside contractor kind of help
So what we're going to talk about, Roberta and Mo and I, is just tasking out those different activities within there, and so that'll definitely be part of the conversation, is just identifying where do we think we have someone who has the capacity to complete this task, and where do we need to start looking at contracting it out. So I agree with you. And that's exactly the purpose of the conversation, is going through each of those activities in detail and determining who can complete them. But you may be right. There may just need to be kind of a oversight sort of role too. But that's why I want to talk with Roberta and then also talk with Mo about how the recovery team can be involved.
No, that sounds good. Yeah, I appreciate that. So yeah, I think all of our staff can pick up just a little bit what we've already talked about, but somebody to coordinate and facilitate and coach, I think we talked about a couple of days ago too. I think we might need to dwell on some outside resources on that.
So. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think there's a lot of ways to think about it. And I definitely want to know what Roberta thinks makes sense. Because she needs to be right there in the mix of how all that's facilitated.
So that could look like not just one outside contractor, but it could be multiple, depending on what part of the pie, so to speak. So.
Yeah, I actually think that's probably likely, because there's just different kinds of things needed, right? I mean, you need someone to do the epidemiological analysis, which maybe will be our epidemiologist person, or maybe will be under the direction of that person or whatever else, depending on time, honestly. And then, you know, there's kind of the community partnerships person, you know, piece, which there may be some folks, and then, you know, there's the vulnerable populations piece. So I agree with you. It may be multiple. I don't think it'll be multiple working 40 hours a week on it, but it, you know, you may kind of contract each of these things out. And then, as Doug said, we may need to just identify kind of a project lead, if you will, to oversee the whole thing.
This question may be more appropriate for the public health session, but do we have a good idea of what each one of the three school districts are planning on doing?
I think that Dr. Harrington does. He's definitely been talking with them.
Yeah, I guess I wonder. My worry is that while at the current level of disease prevalence, it appears that we have adequate contact tracing capability. How quickly does that go out the window if there's multiple cases in the school districts?
Well, a couple things on the Protect Our Neighbors side. One is that part of that is planning for kind of a surge capacity of contact tracers and primarily looking at the concept of cross-training folks, mostly in the, you know, in the county and in the municipalities who could be available if there were a surge needed. So yes, I think as far as protect our neighbors, we're definitely thinking about how we manage something like that. And then I know Dr. Harrington has been talking with the school districts, so he's going to be the right one to ask some questions about what's going on with them.
Okay, and another thing was, and again, this, you know, I'm sure we'll get into it at public health, but it was interesting to me. I had a phone call with a friend, a constituent, and again, kind of complaining about the dashboard and the data and all of that. And I forwarded Robin's press release that she did. Was that on Monday? Yeah, the press release that Robin put out on Monday. And that constituent was going, well, why don't you just put those out? That's all, that's really great information. That really tells us what we need. And I said, well, I think they did a newspaper article on it, but apparently according to this individual, the newspaper article was not as complete as what the press release was. Is that so true?
I guess it's just a question. I mean, I have no idea about that part. I obviously the paper takes it, they don't just print it as is, they turn it into a story. And so sometimes they use different, they use whatever pieces of information they want to focus on, right? But Robin, is there a way for people to sign up to receive our press releases directly? Is that something that you're doing? Do you have it, or is it just going to media?
Well, the press releases are always posted on our website. I don't have a list. On Fridays, if they are the community newsletter that we have on Fridays, I do links to all the press releases that we have done that week. We are signing people up for the community newsletter. We were sending the press release out during COVID-19 to more people on a regular basis, but then we got complaints that it was too much. So it's this kind of fine balance of, so I just decided that on Fridays I would I would put all the press releases of the week in one newsletter. So the way that people sign up is they send an email to county info that we have, the county info at co.rat.co.us. So anybody that you know that wants to get information, if they sign up for that, they'll at least get the Friday newsletter that will have all the information that we put out.
Is that press release, the one you did on Monday, is that available on our website?
Yes, all of our press releases are on our website.
Okay. Yeah, I thought that you did a really good job on that. I thought that was the simplest, most straightforward explanation of what's going on and what the challenges are. So, anything else going on? I imagine
there's plenty going on, but I don't have anything I need to discuss.
You're going to be attending that 2:30. CCAT, Ski Corp call, and I think I will as well.
Yeah.
And what's our expectation coming out of that?
I think really sharing to the governor's office that counties need to be part of the conversation when we're talking about ski season. I mean, that's the biggest. It's kind of a diplomatic mission, if you will. And then talking about just sharing, you know, our knowledge and our concerns and our questions. I think if you look at that agenda that was attached, there's some obvious things there specifically. But I think what we know is that the governor's office has been talking with the industry, but not so much with public health and with counties. And we just are pushing to make sure we're part of the conversation. And then the biggest goal is that we take a statewide approach to ski season.
Right.
You know, that it's not county by county, but that the state is taking a consistent approach to how to deal with it. And I think the biggest thing is that the perspective that counties have here is that you know, it's not so much about the on mountain. It's not about people skiing. You know, skiing is not a particularly dangerous activity when we're talking about COVID. It's more all the other associated things. And we just need to have a good conversation with the governor's office about how we're going to handle that. And a couple weeks ago, when we talked to Jill Ryan and we said, hey, have you guys started working on this yet? She said, no. And so that's what prompted us to say, well, we need to start working on it. But then oddly, I think you maybe received also an invitation, the governor, I don't know, Zander, who's from the governor's office, but I think it's being facilitated by DOLA, maybe, it's not clear, is having a different meeting about ski season tomorrow morning, but they're inviting every person on the face of the planet to that one. That's like all municipalities, all public health directors, et cetera, et cetera. And it'll be another one of those things probably where they talk at us for 25 minutes and then give 3 minutes for questions and then say that they did stakeholder engagement. Excuse my cynicism.
No, just having a statewide set of rules, but it'll be interesting. I mean, will a statewide set of rules for ski operations be applicable if, you know, one county, for instance, has very high disease prevalence and another county has low disease prevalence? Will the state be able to stick with that same set of rules?
Well, I don't know the answer, Tim, and I think that's what we want to talk with them about. And then in addition, you know, it's not just the rules about how the ski areas are operating, which actually the industry is working on a national set of rules based on my conversations. But, you know, lots of counties have concerns about contact tracing and, you know, how we think about employee housing and, you know, the number of visitors that come into town for ski season. And just, we know more now than we did in March, and we should use that information to prepare for the upcoming ski season. And the governor's office shouldn't be doing it without us. That's basically the short version of what we're trying to accomplish there. Hi, Roberta. We were just I like how you have masks that coordinate with all of your outfits.
You should see my shoes.
I'm facilitating a meeting this afternoon between the county commissioners from ski towns and the governor's office, just talking about ski season. Okay. So that's what Tim and I were just catching up about. I know there's a different one tomorrow where that all the LPHAs are invited to, but this one's a little more, I think, of a conversation and less of a presentation from the governor's office.
Yeah, okay. Anyway,
that's just what we were chit-chatting about.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Well, and you know what, like in other ski seasons, you know, we've had issues in Colorado with mumps being transmitted among ski area workers because of the co-housing issue. And there's been several case studies of that occurring. Even during the beginning of COVID-19, there was another couple of cases in the ski areas. So, you know, it's always been a concern from a community.
If they bring that up, I'll make sure to bring that up too. Like, we know some of the risks already because of other communicable diseases.
Yeah, and Beth, I can get you those case studies, those reports that came out from CDC and from CDPHE. Yeah, it's documented.
I got the mumps once in college. I was living in England and they had an outbreak among college students. And I remember I went to the doctor and I said, hold on, I'm vaccinated. What do you mean I have the mumps? And they just told me that sometimes you just grow out of being vaccinated, essentially. It's a childhood illness. And that's just, you're not necessarily immune when you're older. Just have
fun. Yeah, your antibodies can wane, so.
Yeah.
Roberta, Dr. Harrington planning on joining us today?
I think he is. We were working on our presentation earlier, so he should be. Because he's got a whole slide deck.
Right. Well, maybe we can go ahead, it is 10 o'clock, and get started with you and hear your update. And hopefully Dr. Harrington will be joining us shortly.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hello, everyone. Happy Wednesday. A lot of what we wanted to talk about today was some of the data issues, and I wanted to kind of clarify, you know, what's been going on the past couple of weeks that we've done to get our data kind of up to speed and also accurate. We are, Emmy, I don't know if you're able to share slides or if you wanted me to share the slides.
Let me interrupt. I think Dr. Harrington is here. He just needs to get promoted.
Okay. Is that how you get a promotion around here?
That's it. You ask Kendra or Deanna for a promotion.
I'm so happy to be promoted. Thank you, Commissioner Corgan.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Harrington. Go ahead, Roberta.
Sure. Okay. So, I've spent a considerable amount of time last week and this week, you know, really putting together a picture about our data and where we lie with that. And I wanted to, thank Beth, Commissioner Melton. She really helped get me CDRS access. So we were pushing a lot last week to get that CDRS access set up. I finally got CDRS access on Thursday. And on Friday is when I went through the data to really understand where we were at in terms of our reporting. So I put together this presentation just to talk a little bit about how reporting happens. We talked a little bit about CDRS, which is the Colorado Electronic Data System that we use here in public health. So I thought I would start by doing an overview of that and kind of what we have to date. And that is August 9th. We're now going to a reporting of our Monday to Sunday. So that was our previous Sunday here. Emmy, if you could go to the next slide. Emmy? Oh, there we go. Okay, great. So this I thought was a really good graphic. This comes from the CDPHE and some of their training materials. But when we do disease surveillance, especially now with COVID, there are multiple ways that we get data. And that can be through healthcare providers reporting cases to us, or we can get that through the laboratories. And the laboratory data stream is something that is mandatory. So all labs, so if you have a positive COVID test, that lab needs to report it directly to CDPHE. And because of COVID-19, we've got so many labs, the best way to do that is through an electronic feed. So I know this says Mesa County on there. I tried to change the graphic to Rowe County, but I'm not that talented. So we get, there's this information exchange that's happening between laboratories, healthcare providers to report both to the counties and to CDPHE. So that data is coming in those ways. And we are looking at CDRS, so that electronic reporting system, as our main data source. And then that data then is given to CDC, the World Health Organization, and other places then use the data from the CDPHE data system to create their numbers as well. So when we see other places with data, this is primarily where they're getting it from, is from CDPHE. So next slide, please. So with every communicable disease, this is probably more information than you need to know, but I wanted to highlight that third bullet there that talks about the Colorado Electronic Disease Reporting System, or CDERS. So all of the laboratories are encouraged, infection preventionists, public health, that's where we need to be reporting our cases to CDERS. And then it talks about the electronic laboratory reporting that you can have set up with a laboratory that automatically feeds this data into CDERS. And with that data, we get not only all the positives, but we also get the negatives. So if someone submits a test to a laboratory and it's negative, we're able to see that denominator in CDERS. So it's important that labs report this data through the CDERS system. What we found last week is that we have a provider in town, the Steamboat Emergency Center, switched labs at the end of July to a lab in North Carolina who is not reporting to CDERS. So all of the information they were able to give to me last week, this is when I had CDERS access and was able to look and see that the cases that the Steamboat Emergency Center had sent to us, we knew of the positives and we had started contact tracing on those. All of the follow-up was done on those positive cases. They were just not in the CDERS system. So on Friday, I had to manually enter all of those cases that were done at this lab in North Carolina to the CDERS system. So that is why it looks like we have more cases reported in the system, because it was really getting those numbers to align and making sure that all the data we had was also the same data that the state had. Does that make sense?
It does, but I just have a clarification. So it's mandatory to report it to the county or to the state or both? I mean, how is that supposed to work? They were supposed to report it both to us and the state, even if it's not automatically sent to CDERS.
Right, right. So, you know, the notification that comes to public health is that immediate, hey, we've had a positive. It takes CDERS, you know, it depends on the lab and the amount of data that's being uploaded. It can take a day or two for that data to appear in CDERS. So that's why it's important when these cases are positive that we follow up on them immediately, because there is that lag in the uploading of that from the lab into CDERS. So that verbal, that, you know, emailed confirmation is we do need to continue to do that and not just rely on CDERS for the information. So that's how that timing goes.
So that begs the question, and maybe you were going to get to this anyway in a minute, which is obviously we want that that information about any new positive cases instantly or as soon as possible from the local agency that may have conducted the test and has the result. Mm-hmm. But that, as far as all of the questions about data presentation on a dashboard, does it make sense to just rely upon CDERS data and stop attempting to put all that together ourselves?
Absolutely. And that's what we'd like to move to, is use the CDERS data, because that is going to be congruent with decisions that CDPHE is making. They're looking at this data, you know, and they noticed that we had added new cases on Friday. And I said, well, that was a result of me getting access on Thursday and seeing all of the missing data on Friday. So, but again, we knew about those cases and had followed up with them from a public health standpoint. It was more from that database system that they weren't in there. So I have talked to the emergency center and to their lab about getting access to CDRs. And I've let CDPHE know that their lab isn't set up to report to CDRs. So they were going to reach out as well to see how we could make that happen and get that data feed in there as well. Next slide, Emmy. So given that, I wanted to put together a slide. So I was able to go back to the beginning of March through August 9th, and these are our confirmed and probable cases. So the number on the CDPHE website has both confirmed and probable cases combined. So I wanted to show the breakdown again through August 9th of what is in CDRs. So confirmed, we have 116 confirmed and 8 probable that give us the grand total of 124. There was a duplicate in the system and CDPHE was saying 125. So I deleted that duplicate entry. So, you know, it takes a while for some of that data to then catch up after we clean it up a little bit. But again, remember, I took this data. This was Sunday at 2 p.m. when I did this graph. So things do change from, you know, then until today, but just to give you a picture of where we are with our data and how the numbers look. And those cases that I mentioned that weren't in CDRs all were in mostly late July, mid-July. There were some that were at the beginning of July as well. And then next slide, Emmy. So then I was able to break it down because I know some people are, you know, have heard in through the paper that we've reported, you know, a female in her 20s tested positive. So what I did is I broke the data down even further. I've really begun to have a nice appreciation for pivot tables in Excel. So I was able to pull this data looking at the breakdown by gender, again, looking from the March to the August 9th timeframe, breaking it down into confirmed and our probable cases to see how those break out, because I know we have reported information that gives gender and age. So hopefully this gives you a better perspective kind of where we're at in terms of our case counts in the county in this age group. You know, our 20 and 30 year olds, 50 year olds for the females, you know, it's the males, our 20 year old males out there. So anyway. Are there any questions about these last two slides here in that data?
No, it's well presented, Roberta, and easily understandable. Thank you.
Yes, and I do have this, and I gave it to Robin as well, that if we even wanted to break it down by each day in March, each day in April, I have that data as well. It was just very busy to present in a slide and I didn't want to do that to you so early in the morning. So, but we do have it by day as well. And Emmy has updated our slides on the webpage, our data there to reflect all of the daily positives. So we went through and cross-checked and made sure all of our data was matching based on what is in the CDRS reporting system. So.
I have a question, Roberta. Do you know how the state is tracking the data in terms of what date they're using? I ask because I heard Dr. Herlihy say the other day that she prefers to look at date of symptom onset But I find that a little confusing because I don't know how you do that when someone is asymptomatic. And I know a big part of what we're trying to do is catch those asymptomatic cases. So I think it's good that we've chosen something that's consistent. I think that's probably the best thing we can do. But is that consistent with the state, or are they doing something different? Do you know?
You know, with their data, I'm not sure if that is symptom onset. I would be, because not every case in there has that field filled out. You know, a lot of that comes out of our contact tracing and talking with the individual. So if that information's not collected on every patient, then, you know, there's more variability, I think, on that. What we use with this is by collection date, which, you know, we had talked about, I think, last week, that collection date, you know, that's your point in time when you were tested. So if you were positive, then, you know, regardless when you get the lab back, it's that point in time, and we can better see where and when our disease is happening by that collection date. So that's kind of more of the solid number that we use to pull this data. And I'll have to get back with you, Beth, on that and see if in fact they are doing that. I know their data is reported. You know, they update it every day by 4 from the CDER system. So I'll check into that. I'll talk to our contact and see how they are using that onset date in their analysis.
Yeah, I mean, just generally, I think, you know, or maybe you don't know, that I'm in this work group that's looking at the variants process and the safer at home, and kind of looking at for the state thresholds and sort of trying to make some more gradients within safer at home to help help communities make good decisions around when, what kind of changes to make, when to make changes, things like that. And I think, you know, if you start talking about thresholds, it's just, I think it's important to understand kind of what are we talking about, and we're talking about a 2-week time period. Are we talking about the people who were tested in that time period, the people who were symptomatic in that time period, the people who got their test results back in that time period? So just would be helpful, I think, to understand both. I think there are pros and cons to any of those methods, and the best we can do is to be consistent in how we're doing it and how we're looking at our data.
So
how that aligns with the state.
Yeah, so I know with symptom onset too, just with the patients that I've called recently, like you mentioned, Commissioner Melton, that there can be asymptomatic people. So, you know, our isolation is then based on that collection date when they were tested. But sometimes people don't think about their symptoms. They're like, well, I kind of had a headache. I don't know if this was truly a symptom, but then, you know, a couple days I felt worse. So it's like, which symptom are you going to attribute to their COVID, you know, or maybe to the stressful day they had, or to maybe dehydration. So, you know, it's variable on those symptoms, but I think that is a good question and would be maybe be a better way to understand our data. I'm excited that we do have someone that will be joining us to help us with our data. And those, I think, are the questions that with a deeper analysis, we could actually break down and look at that from a statistical standpoint and from a data analysis standpoint to get even further deeper into this picture.
Thank you.
Sure. So Emmy, I don't know if you want to show, or Dr. Harrington, if you would like to discuss the rest of the data picture.
Just one quick comment on that last slide, and you don't need to put it back up, but I guess what was interesting to me about it was the relatively even distribution of disease prevalence across all age groups. That one standout age group that, I mean, there was a couple of age groups that appeared to have a higher prevalence, but not dramatically.
Right, right. And we did, you know, we did see a couple of, we have seen a couple of positive in our teens as well. And so, you know, again, when we're thinking about back to school, you know, that population, we certainly want to keep a close eye on as well. So. Dr. Harrington, did you want to?
Sure. I mean, Emmy can put up the couple slides I had. I'll just comment. We didn't see this in her job description, but Roberta has some background that I think is very helpful for what she was doing this past weekend. As she was putting in, you know, a lot of time, it was a marathon of sort. Well, I've learned that she's an Ironman triathlete, so that came handy, I think, here in recent days for her. Yeah, our data, you know, I think that the data story is really one of the past 3 weeks. We just had this combination of events. We lost our public health nurse, our public health director. We had a transition to a new person, and we've explained that in the past. And I think Roberta has now got her hands around the data, and she's done, with some help with Emmy, a lot of work to sort things out. And so, you know, I want to just talk about our metrics, the numbers that we calculate a bit. I would say that there's two key things, and I've said this before, that we focus on. It's the case positivity rate, and then the case rate per 100,000, if you will, for our population. And there's a couple levels there that seem to be fairly well accepted marks. I would accept 5% as our case positivity rate, and I would accept that 10 per 100,000 7-day average rate for cases per population. Well, so how do we come up with these numbers? I mean, the math actually is not that tough. So here are the assumptions, or here are the variables we put into these things. So we take this past week, a 7-day period. By convention, we're looking at Monday through Sundays. And so this last week, 3rd through the 9th, we had 6 cases. I am using a Rout County population of 25,683. And go ahead and flip here, Emmy, next. And here's the calculation. So you take 6 cases per our Rout County population, you adjust that to make it per 100,000, and then you divide it by 7 days in a week. And that's where you come up with a daily case rate on average, so over the past 7 days, of 3.34 cases per 100,000. I would highlight that that is not at the 10 cases per 100,000 mark. Now, if people look at the Harvard Institute of Global Health, yesterday they listed us at 10. Today, they list us at 9.5 per 100,000. I disagree with that calculation. This is the numbers we use, and it's in our spreadsheets to say what our case rate per 100 population daily average is. It is 3.34. Again, that's based on 6 cases during the past week. It's possible we might get a case result or two come in over the next few days. It could be 8 over that. Well, that's not going to appreciably change what our case rate per day population averages right now. So I know somebody had communicated with us that we were at 10 and why weren't we doing something. I would suggest that 10 rate is not correct. This is the number. I am comfortable with it. It's based on the numbers that we've shared with you. Go ahead, Emmy. Next slide. Case danger level. You know, so how many cases do we have to have in a week or 2 weeks to get to be more worried, to make changes. So if we take this 10 cases per 100,000 population rate over, averaged over a week, that would give us a mark. We want to be under an average of 2.57 cases per day, or that comes out to be almost exactly 18 cases per week. So if we were to hit 18 cases per week, given our population, this would put us at that danger level of necessitating the new level of changes in our community. And I think, as we all know, we have actually never hit 18 cases per week. This week, we were at 6. So again, I consider these to be relatively acceptable numbers. Before we move into our spreadsheet.
Is that a rolling average that you're working with, or the numbers for just one given week?
So the numbers I have here, by the way, I've calculated this out, would be the average over the week.
Okay.
So then I took that. But our spreadsheet, you could actually move the cursor over each day and it gives you for that day the average. I think with our little numbers too, we want to be a little careful jumping day by day. I think really we want to smooth it out a little bit and do it an average over a week.
So to the question,
go ahead.
Sorry. To that, your last point there, one of the other things I heard Dr. Herlihy say the other day was that while a lot of folks are using a 7-day average, she prefers a 14-day average for Colorado, mostly because when we're looking at these small numbers, there's a lot of noise, right? If you get two extra cases, you get this crazy spike, you know, or whatever. And so I guess I'm just curious about your thoughts on that. And generally what I would think is we should look at both, right? And we should understand what both are telling us. But I guess I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that 7 days versus 14 days.
Well, our discussions have been necessitated by weekly board meetings. So our discussions include what's happened in the past week. So because of that relevance, I considered the last week always to be relevant to our discussions of what's changed in the past week. Now, some of our spreadsheet stuff here does include a 14-day deal. And we originally had kind of focused on that, but we've kind of morphed into more of a, you know, what's gone on in the past week and how does that compare to the previous weeks. It certainly does smooth the data out a bit to go over the 14-day average. I, as you say, I think it's relevant to look at both what's happened in the past week and then how does that look in the longer picture as well as the 14-day one. So I don't disagree with him or her. It's all information to consider.
And just one other question. I know you probably don't know for sure, but why do you think the Harvard number is so much higher than the way you've calculated it? My best guess is that they're just pulling that Cedars data and we had some kind of older cases added recently, but I guess, you know, what's your best guess about why they're calculating it so differently?
Well, as I mentioned, that 10 number would be based on having 18 cases in 2 weeks. 18 cases in a week. We had 12 cases the previous week, 6 cases this week. So I don't know if they're adding different weeks somehow. I mean, if that's, they don't have the granularity of the data that we do. So it's a curious coincidence that their rate of 10 yesterday would be based on us having 18 cases in a week, which we haven't had. But that just tells me maybe they're getting the data in a slightly fuzzy way. I'm not sure. And that's why I've explained this. This, our number is not 10. It is, as I said, 3.34. And those are the numbers I've used and we came from, and we're very confident in the amount of cases we've had in our community.
The CDPHE also has an open data source on their page. And I haven't sifted through those databases at all to see how, if they differ in any way, like are they putting cleaned Cedars data in there? How is that raw data being put into that open database? So, you know, that might be a task that we can reach out to CDPHE and just kind of ask about the source of that open data source, because I think, you know, some of these research facilities might be using that data then to generate some of these numbers.
Well, and we've said all along, I mean, we have to talk about this locally. And I mean, you guys do know the positive cases we've had, and your analysis of the data is going to be the most useful to us for making decisions locally. But I do know that a lot of folks look at that national, you know, look at the New York Times or look at Johns Hopkins or look at Harvard. So it's just helpful to understand why there might be differences between those data sources.
Well, let's look at our dashboard now, which I think is going to look better to you. Emmy in particular is our key person on this and taking information that Roberta has cleaned up. So we've got, as we said, 6 cases in the past 7 days, 16 in the past 2 weeks. Don't worry about that red color. That doesn't necessarily signify anything. So let's look at the first graph that we have there. So this graph is looking at number of cases by week. And one thing that you could kind of point out with some interest is the 29th week is July 13th through 19. As this data matured, I think you might see a little bit of a peak here relative to our July 4th weekend. I can't prove that. It's just, you know, if we had supposed that the July 4th weekend was going to have a lot of group gatherings, lots of people, and therefore we would see the case rates go up about 2 to 3 weeks later. Well, here we go. The 29th week is the week of July 13th through the 19th. So perhaps that is relevant. But these numbers, I think, are very mature. The last week, of course, we will have some numbers maybe still outstanding. But you can see here our case rates. And then if you go back all the way to that week 26, that does represent that cluster of cases we had. There were about 8 or 9 related cases there. But so here is our weekly totals of cases going back to mid-June when we started getting cases again.
So Dr. Harrington, I just think it's probably worth pointing out for you know, folks who maybe aren't as accustomed to looking at this kind of data, that while there looks like a pattern here, if you look at the raw numbers, it's a difference of 2 or 3 cases when we look at that peak in week 29. So just, I mean, without running a full statistical analysis, I would have to guess that that is not probably statistically significant given these small numbers. I don't know if you would agree with that.
Well, it might approach it just from my familiarity with some of the stuff in the past. I mean, if you're talking 10 cases and you go from 10 to 13, it has to do with the confidence interval. You know, when you get into statistics about how confident you are that the result is actually real, when you have small numbers like this, your confidence interval gets quite wide. I don't know, Roberta, should we get into this slide presentation next week on p-values and...
Yeah, I think we had a nice discussion about p-values the other day.
And small,
I don't need that.
I don't know if we have to start calculating p-values, but I just think for the benefit of the public, it's important to point out that we're still talking about very small numbers here, and we do have to obviously look at trends and analyze those trends, but we also have to be a little cautious in how we analyze them because the numbers are so small.
Can I go ahead and scroll on down there? If I can read the screen here, I think that's number of cases by day. And this one really should be qualified. I mean, you know, we don't do a lot of testing on Sundays, so we'll never have spikes on a Sunday. So to some degree, the day data is a little bit, relative of just when we do tests. That's why, and that gets into this idea too, if you want to smooth out the data over a period of time. And then next, number of cases per 100,000 people by week. Then we have the next graph, which is, again, it's a little hard for me to read on the screen here, 7-day average of positive tests. And then, okay, so this is this our positive rate, Emmy? 7-day average positive test. Yep. So if you move the cursor, well, so we have the move the cursor over one of those days, and what you'll have on there is that test rate, I believe.
The last 7-day average test positive rate, as well as the last 7-day average new cases per 100,000 people.
So that is where we have our rolling average. And so that's the way we've got that working on the spreadsheet is that it's going to take the numbers from the previous 7 days and average them for that average rate.
So this is not just using the Sunday to or Monday to Sunday. This is a rolling average, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And the good news is that the positivity rate continues to stay below 5%.
Yes.
Significantly below. I mean, it's below 2%, right?
And I think through the weeks, as I've calculated these numbers too, this is, you know, I've tended to find this in that 2 to 3% range. Population by week. I think I'm reading it. It's really small on my screen. Sorry. Seven-day average. Go ahead, Amy.
Yeah, it's the same as the previous one, just summed by week instead of day. And then these two graphs we've had on the website for a couple of weeks now, and so they're just showing some trends.
And we'll just make note of the Unicast social distancing data. We're still, well, we were kind of before, could be better. So I feel like our dashboard data is getting much closer to what we want it to be. I think the data is good. Roberta in particular has put a lot of work into, you know, just sorting out. We have so many variables that go into this. You know, we've got 8 clinical entities in our county alone that provide data. And then when we have patients that go down to Children's Hospital or National Jewish for a procedure or anywhere else, and they get a screening test, or maybe they're down to visit someone and they get a test. You know, those are all sources of data that feed into the CDER system and hopefully feed in accurately. And we've always looked at those. I mean, through time, we've reconciled. I mean, I've worked with Michelle in a couple of the previous public health nurse on a couple of occasions. We did exactly this, where we were trying to work out what the difference in the numbers were. But in the last couple, 3 weeks, we were in transition. But it seems to me that we've kind of caught up now. It's very labor intensive, though, and it is going to be, I think, key for us to get a person dedicated to working this who gets very familiar with the data flow and can keep track of it.
One of the, I actually attended the last meeting of that work group that Beth was talking about, and there was a lot of, and by the way, the dashboard looks great. I mean, that kind of information, I think, should satisfy a lot of the questions that we've been getting from the public. I'd be hard pressed right now to try to identify something that's missing out of that data, but I'm sure someone will let us know if it is. But in any case, at that work group, Pitkin County's dashboard was identified as a useful dashboard, but primarily just for one item on it, which is at the very top of their dashboard. There's a thing that they call the coronavirus meter, and it's kind of based on a 4-color system of, on the left, you're doing great, you'd be green, and then it moves up to yellow, and then orange, and then red. And the attempt that they have done in Pitkin County is to amalgamate all of this data to arrive at this one very simple looking meter that lets you, at a glance, let the public know, are we doing really good? Are we doing really bad? Or are we somewhere in the middle? It's probably an oversimplification, but for those individuals that don't want to pore over all of the data, they just want that quick snapshot of how are we doing, it seemed like an effective communication tool.
I have found it challenging to come up with a perfect color score. I mean, we have different scales out there. We've got Safer at Home scales. We've got Protect Our Neighbor scales, and they're used for different things. We've got the Harvard Institute of Global Health. They've got their color scale. The state webpage lists their community of incidence rate, and that's where, you know, we talk about this being a moderate high rate. And so we've got these different ones, and they're sometimes used for different things. And so the challenge is, you know, which one are we going to use?
Mm-hmm. Right. I also have some updates too for some of the information that's come through CDPHE if we're done with a data discussion.
I just have one other, I've been just like racking my brain on this because I just feel like it was a little confusing. Dr. Harrington, could we go back to the two slides where you looked at our rate per 100,000? I was thinking about it and thinking about it, and I think I finally figured out why it was confusing. I just want to make sure that I understand it. So will you go back one before that to where what our actual rate is. So on this one, you said that our current rate is 3.34. And then on the next one, you said the danger rate was 2.5. And it just, without thinking about it very hard, it seems like we've exceeded that. Once I thought about it a little more, I figured it out. But would you just explain the difference between those two?
Yeah, so let's go back there for just a minute. Go back to the previous slide, Emmy. So here's our average. Yep. Average per day. Then we go forward to the next page. I gotta see what
that's our average per day per 100,000.
Yep.
Right. Yep. And then this 2.57 would be the actual number, not
yes. But oh, route daily cases. So that's per the 25,000.
Right, not per 100,000.
Right.
So per 100,000, that's 10. So the number to compare to the 3.34 is 10. The number to compare to 2.57 is actually 6 divided by 7.
I believe that's correct. Yeah. Okay. No, that yeah. We talk about those numbers, but then yeah, they don't quite. Yeah, that is confusing. Sorry.
No, at first I was like, wait, and then I just wanted to make sure that I had that right. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Good math there, Commissioner Milton.
On the fly.
So CDPHE did come out with a HON last week, and this is looking at people that test positive again within 90 days. We have seen some people who have tested positive and then maybe get retested maybe a month later or a couple of weeks later, and they have a positive result. And so CDPHE came out with guidance on those people that have tested positive again within that 90-day timeframe. And it pertains to isolation. And you know, those people, if you do test positive, again, we wouldn't put them back on a 10-day isolation because potentially they're just persistently positive. We're seeing this happen, you know, with some cases that, you know, a couple of months out, they are still positive, but without symptoms. And also part of that isolation order is that you can only tell inside jokes.
Seriously, Roberta, you just don't need to step into Dr. Harrington's territory. I think he's got that pretty well covered.
No, I need help. I need help.
I have a quick question. The tests, the positive tests, are they a combination? I think I've asked this before, but I'll ask it again. Are they a combination of the PCR and the antigen tests?
No, we took the antigen tests out. So in CDRs, those are listed as suspect cases. So we took that out of the analysis and only went with the confirmed, the PCR positive tests for this analysis.
Thank you.
And I would comment that through the past few months, there's been some extra tests out there, and those are the ones that they do label as suspect. I think it's possible with the new antigen test coming out that they may reclassify whether they consider those suspect or whether they accept them as definite.
And that's another issue with if we do start seeing the rapid antigen tests in town, from a data standpoint, you know, that's the big question. How will this be reported again into the CDRS system with these point of care testing? And, you know, that's going to be a huge manual effort if there's not a way to electronically, you know, download those data sets and get it into the reporting system.
So the next question I have is, when you receive a positive result from an antigen test, I assume that we treat that the same as a positive result from a PCR test from the perspective of contact tracing and isolation orders? Or am I not making a proper assumption?
I would say yes, we've not yet had really many antigen tests done and none that we've had to act on. Mm-hmm. But going forward, certainly if we get a positive antigen test reported from a clinic using the new Sophia Quidel model, for example, I presume we would treat the same way.
I think we would also ask for a history, you know, to go back and see if they had been reported previously with a positive, PCR test. So
the challenge with the antigen tests has been they have a low enough sensitivity that they run the risk of false negatives. Mm-hmm. But they have high specificity, and as such, if they do have a positive test, it is likely to be a correct positive test.
But it's likely to miss positive cases. So then it would make sense to treat a positive as a positive, but we just can't rely on those tests to know if someone is positive.
Right. I'm positive about that.
Okay.
And if these antigen tests become more widely used, it could theoretically start turning up more positive cases than we would have found out about otherwise, creating additional strain in our contact tracing capability. Yes,
right? Possibly, yes.
So can I just ask,
I mean, we talked through all those numbers. Can you give just sort of a qualitative assessment? I mean, I know that this question keeps coming up, you know, is our disease prevalence rising? Do we need to take additional measures to control disease prevalence, et cetera? And I can say what I think I would assume based on the data you've given us, but if you would just kind of give us your qualitative assessment of where we're at based on that data, I think that would be helpful as well.
Well, I think certainly from a state perspective, they've started to see the numbers kind of level off. And to quote Dr. Herlihy, she had cautious optimism in the direction of the cases. And so I would probably use that same phrase. And again, you know, it really depends on how good as a community we can continue our five commitments to containment, our social distancing, our mask use, our washing of our hands, and, you know, really continuing to do these things. It doesn't mean just because we have maybe potentially fewer cases that lessens the importance of doing that. I've talked to a couple people recently and they said, well, I need to know the numbers. And I said, well, you know, we're working on the numbers and getting our dashboard updated. And I asked, how will that change your daily behavior? So if we have less numbers, are you going to do anything differently based on what you're doing today? We're still in a pandemic. We're still in a situation where we need to eliminate this virus. And these are our tools that we can use. And we still need to continue to use those tools regardless of what our data is saying right now.
I would continue to summarize the prevalence of COVID-19 in our community, and the transmission rate is moderate. We're clearly not low, we're clearly not high, and that's in part by the state's own cumulative incidence data report. It's been interesting how through July and now, we have stayed relatively stable. We clearly haven't gone down, but I don't think we've gone up. We're not where we would want to be. And our numbers are small enough, it's hard to say week by week, but we may get to the point, you know, where you look back to previous 2 months ago, oh yeah, here's the inflection of the curve, or here's where it did start to go up. But so far, that would not be the case in my estimation. We need to do better. I don't think it's acceptable, the amount of disease we have in our community, but we are managing it. And we're managing it to the extent that it has not spiked up. I thought that by this point in time, we would have more cases. And that has not been the case. And I am very happy that has proven me wrong. But we also haven't gone down. It stayed stable. And, you know, we've made it through this tourist season just about. I know we got another week or two of the big tourist numbers, but I think as the data there shows, it's not been this big spike that could have really gotten us in trouble. It's just too bad that as we head into the school season and fall and cold and flu stuff, that we're not starting at a lower prevalence level in our community.
Has the state done any modeling based upon schools reopening?
I haven't seen it in the last 2 weeks, but their previous modeling did not really fully incorporate that in terms of what I saw for some of their assumptions on it. I mean, their modeling has been based on social distancing and all those factors. But, you know, what's the factor that you put in for school? We don't, I haven't seen that. They may be doing it. I just, when I last looked at their metrics on it, they didn't have a particular school factor.
Everything I've heard them talk about, they really are using hospitalization numbers for modeling, and then kind of backing out the other factors from that. And I think really the only things, I mean, they're putting mask wearing into their model, and they're putting, you know, the expected R naught versus the actual observed R naught. And that's sort of how they're doing their modeling based on what I have seen. I don't think they're putting in all these various kinds of individual factors. What I heard Dr. Hurley say the other day is how they're describing social distancing is basically just all human behavior that we can't fully account for within our model.
Yeah.
And the difference between the expected R naught and the observed R naught is kind of how they're calculating social distancing. So Tim, I guess I don't think so is my answer, unless there's something that we haven't seen.
But intuitively, the idea of school starting back up again in person classes, one would expect to see some increase in the number of positive cases, would we not?
I would agree. There's two broad conceptual approaches to the modeling. One concept is to take population health data, especially from other countries and places, and say, well, when they did this, we saw this rate of change. And then there's another conceptual approach where you're basing it on the actual numbers in that community, and maybe to the point of ignoring kind of what patterns have happened in other cases. When we look around the world at all these countries that opened schools, almost all of them did so with a lower level of disease prevalence than we're doing in the United States right now. So while there can be some reassuring things from those things, we're kind of doing this at a different state than what, you know, South Korea did or whatever like that. You can certainly argue that it's better to use real numbers and numbers from your local population. And I think that's kind of what our state folks have been doing somewhat. And it does indirectly confer stuff. But of course, when we look at our numbers throughout this disease in our state, I mean, we shut down schools in March. We really don't have data to tell us what happens when you have kids in school in Colorado. We will be seeing that for the first time next month.
Tim, you're just talking to yourself over there.
I'm sorry. And I don't mind talking. I do talk to myself quite a bit. In this particular case, I had a question for Roberta. Have you received any new information from CDPHE on the contact tracing software platform? And if so, do you see that as something that Route County might want to participate in?
Right. So there is a new portal for local public health agencies for collecting some of the contact tracing information. So I was able to register us yesterday for that portal and get us set up on there and really see, you know, what's coming through. I think it's going to be a great communication tool to share contact tracing information and access those tools. So we are now a part of that, that portal. We also I've signed us up for kind of a help, if you will, when needed, contact tracing through CDPHE. They have a pool of contact tracers that they have trained. It's like over 300 people that they have trained formally in contact tracing. So if we ever needed, if we had a surge where we did need this service, they would, you know, I guess I send out the bat signal or something, but I hit a help button, and they will provide additional contact tracers that are fully set and ready to jump in to help us. Right now, like I mentioned last week, we have some fantastic folks working for us and helping out. But if we ever needed a surge capacity, we do have access to that. And I think all of that information then would flow through this portal. In terms of how that is electronically recorded beyond that, I do need to look into that. We've got a couple of local public health calls here today, and I hope to get that information on how that's moving forward.
Will that that software, will that alleviate any burden on our contact tracers, or is it just one more additional piece of data entry that they need to do?
Well, and I think it would be good to collect it electronically so we have everything in one space and we can look at it real time. I think that that is somewhat the challenge when you have people collecting information here and there, you know, how can we get this all uniform in one space and have it, you know, access to that, where if we needed to look up something quickly, it would give us that access, so.
And then I'm thinking that if this data regarding contact tracing is being collected, Beth, would it help inform Rauch County's ability to fulfill the needs of contact tracing as part of the Protect Our Neighbors framework?
I would think so. I mean, just, and Roberta and I have been talking a little bit about the Protect Our Neighbors planning. Part of what's in the planning process is to determine what would be kind of that place where we would need additional resources. You know, how many cases would that need to be, that sort of thing. And looking at various tipping points, that being one of them. But yes, you're right. I think all of us probably have and should continue to have some healthy skepticism of over-reliance on the state systems, just because we wouldn't want to be caught flat-footed if they weren't able to follow through in the middle of an emergency. So I don't think it hurts for us to have our own plan as well. But certainly the idea that we could utilize that, it is a good one in my mind. I don't know what your thoughts about that are, Roberta.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, the more information we have, it's truly going to inform the picture. And it's just, it just makes those numbers, like we said, tell a story maybe even better. So we have a better picture of what's going on in transmission, for sure.
Can that contact be done remotely, or does that have to be done on site? So if they ask the state to come help, are they going to have to come here to help, or they do it remotely?
Yeah, so they do it remotely, and all of our contact tracers currently are working remotely. You know, a lot of this data is collected on the weekends, in the evenings. You know, you're trying to contact people and they might not be home during the day or answering their phone. So it's really a 24/7 operation that can be done remotely, and everyone has secure systems. So, you know, we're very careful about confidentiality, and everything is sent through secure emails and through secure servers. So we are taking those precautions as well.
Do we have a sense at this point? One of the numbers that has been of interest to me in some of the metrics I've looked at is understanding what percentage of our cases we're catching through contact tracing mm-hmm. versus just testing. And I think that's one of the things the state is also looking at as we think about metrics going forward, because I think it really reflects what our capacity is, you know, for containment. Do we have a sense of that with our current information?
You know, I think now that we've gotten up to speed with our current information and CDRs, that is really the next step to start digging into. And I would really love to see the data we have on that and start looking at that in a more in-depth, because as you mentioned, yes, we need to be looking at this for those next phases in our crisis here.
So until recent weeks, I had been reporting on that. That's that kind of story theme I would talk about. You know, it was always reassuring to have stories. Somebody traveled out of state to a wedding, they got it and they came back. Somebody was connected. You know, when we had a spouse who was positive and their spouse got positive, I liked hearing those stories. And a couple, 3 weeks ago, last time that I had that information available, I did comment that we had a few more of the situations without a story. Now, granted, when we're talking 6 or 8 cases a week, what's the significant difference? But that is something that is important and does reflect our prevalence in the community. And the point being there is if we have a lot of cases where we don't find where they got it, then that just suggests the increased prevalence and it's more widespread in our community. And that's, you know, a concerning mark, if you will.
Well, and I think just in the conversations that I've been able to be involved with, the state, you know, it's heading in that direction of some of these more nuanced things, because you might find several cases, but they all, like, you know, that peak we had earlier in July, or maybe it was June, where, but they were all related to each other. So actually, it's probably a success story because we caught those and prevented them from becoming a broader outbreak within the community. And so you kind of have to weigh those things with one another when you're talking about what's our level of concern about disease prevalence in our community. And it's just more nuanced than the number of cases, I think. So it's helpful to know. And I'm excited that the state is trying to look at this and hopefully give us some helpful kind of consistent recommendations about how everyone is looking at this. I'm hoping that's the outcome. That's definitely the goal of this work group.
Another question on the data that I had was, the data that you've presented so far today does not segregate out the cases at Casey's Pond or at the Haven, correct?
Correct.
So is there any benefit in segregating that data and looking at the dashboard without those cases?
Yes, that is a nuance. And we've, you know, in the past, that's been our convention is to not ignore them, but do consider them also as a separate thing. I mean, if we had the one slide up where we had cases, I was going to comment how 2-3 weeks ago, our case count reflected what is now a total of 11 cases over at the facility in Hayden. And so, yeah, that's a story, right? You see the pathway. Mm-hmm. And so that does modify how we interpret the total case count. Mm-hmm. In an area, you know, if we had 10 cases and 8 of them were from a facility outbreak, I would definitely consider our transmission, our community to be relatively lower than what that number reflects.
Yeah. And even in the testing numbers, you know, when we were looking at CDRs at that denominator of how many tests have been done, you can see that, Casey's Pond is doing significant testing on Mondays. So, you know, you see that number of tests and, you know, our community tests, you can tell, you know, those are done on Wednesdays. And so you can look at that data and, you know, parse it out if that's something, you know, we want to for future to look at.
And yet, as I'm sure we all appreciate, we can't ignore those numbers. Mm-hmm. And I mean, people have died at both facilities. And we are intimately connected with those facilities in terms of the staff and visitors and all that. So what's going on in our community has directly led to the disease occurring in those facilities.
Could you just, while we're on that topic, what is the status of the outbreak at the Haven? I know the state comes in and works on that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, yes. So CDPHE has been helping us with that. We did do another round of, it's today, Wednesday. we'll be out there testing again today, those residents and staff again. So we did have another positive case last week with a staff member, but you know, we'll see what this week's data brings.
Dr. Harrington, so you've characterized our current situation as neither particularly good nor particularly bad. They feel, you know, we're kind of hovering along at this current level of disease prevalence. And I've heard you say that you wish it was lower, which I'm sure we all do. Do you think that there's more action that we as the Board of Health should be taking to address that? Or do you think that it's acceptable to continue on with this relatively flat curve that we have?
I think that in our current state, it's tolerable, but I'm concerned that as we move into the fall, we're starting at too high of a mark. That's both kind of a linear thing. Okay, if you start here and you get more cases, you're gonna go up this way. But it's also an exponential thing. The more disease we have in our community, the more it's going to grow more rapidly. And I have fear that we have set ourselves up for a worse fall in terms of the typical stuff that we see. And now that we have schools starting. And to make our school start a success, we should be aiming for a lower disease prevalence in our community. To do that, we can do better at what we're doing. We've discussed this before. You know, we're doing well on face masks wearing. We could debate the social distancing and how we're doing on that. The way that you get this, you know, kind of the model or the way this disease gets around is it has to do with the nature of contact with other people, the frequency of contact with other people, and then kind of really that's the travel. I mean, are you going to places where there's a lot of disease? And so that, you know, the nature of it has to be, are you doing indoor stuff? Are you doing stuff in a certain kind of activity where people are doing a lot of breathing hard or doing something? Then the frequency of it is this, you know, how many people are you in contact with? It's a math thing. The more people you're in contact with, the more likely you are to get the disease. And then relative to the travel part is our, you know, are we going to these places where there's a lot of disease and bringing it back? So I feel like our community has done well. I'm sure we can all do better, and we could make a commitment. We could decide this month that we're all going to consciously reduce our social interactions. We could quantify that in some way. We could remind everybody, hey, let's keep the group activities down to 10. Or if you're thinking of having a large group activity this month, maybe consciously choose not to do it. If we get into rising cases or getting to some level that's concerning, then I think we're talking about new measures. And that would be a reflection on kind of the steps that we got here, but it would be a reflection of what are, you know, those activities that have a high risk nature to them or a high volume. We would look at our group sizes. Do we limit our group sizes further? Do we limit certain activities? Now, I'm not gonna say that this is my prioritization or that this is the rank order, but think about the things that we open up late. We open up gyms late. We've been expanding restaurants and bars. We've had other group activities that we've kind of opened up. We've had lodging issues. Those are all realms that we could get into if we feel that we need to do something different to get a handle on stuff. So I think that we should be looking at improving our measures or as we get into what is likely to be more disease with cold and flu season. I say that loosely. That's, you know, as we get into cold weather, people are indoors more. It just, that's when we see this stuff spreading. And then it's probably related to the start of school and children getting together in school.
So it sounds like what you're talking about. I think people, you know, saw what happened in the spring and think about the only tools being things like public health orders and shutting things down and that sort of thing. But from a public health standpoint, I mean, there's a lot that public health does to help change behaviors, to help reduce disease prevalence, that is not those kinds of regulatory tools. And I think what you're referring to is some of those other kinds of tools. It's education campaigns, it's identifying kind of collective efforts we might make as a community. And I guess I would, I think what you're talking about makes a lot of sense. And I don't think we should resign ourselves to the fact that we have to go into the fall with this higher disease prevalence. You know, we're not there yet. We have a few weeks that, we could reverse course. And it seems like taking those kind of education type efforts, which honestly is probably more what public health is good at than all these regulatory type of efforts. You know, we could get headed, pointed more in the right direction as we head into fall and into winter. And I think it would be a worthy effort. And I guess I would be curious what your suggestions would be about how to embark on that. What does that look like? And I know Tim asked the question, so maybe he has some comments, but that would be my thoughts.
Well, number one, I agree with you, Beth, and I think the last thing any of us wants to do is start issuing new restrictive public health orders. I mean, that's the avenue of last resort as far as I'm concerned. So, I'm looking for, and given that Dr. Harrington's so good at turning a phrase into something amusing and interesting, I'm sure by now he's got some kind of great slogan that we could use as part of a public education campaign.
Oh, I think Robin's the turning for phrase. We'll have to ask her to help with that.
But I guess the thought that I've given to it is just, and I am by no means any kind of a marketing expert, but I've kind of thought of it in this way, which is really putting the question to our community, which is, do you really want to see schools open? Do you really want to see a successful ski season? Then this is what we need to do. But that comes across as kind of threatening, so I don't know how helpful.
Well, and I think, Tim, there's also a message that, like, this is crunch time, right? We have gotten to a level of disease prevalence that, as Dr. Harrington said, it's stable, but it's too high if we're going to go into fall and winter successfully. And so I think a sense of urgency in that messaging is, and honestly, a sense of kind of, we need to tighten up for a few weeks here. I mean, but think about this in manageable chunks for people. And again, we're not going to be obviously back to normal at the end of that chunk of time, but it'll put us in a better place for things to work as we go into the fall and winter.
I mean, people can ask themselves, at our current level, we could continue through the rest of the year at this level. And I would think that we would accept it as not a bad outcome. We've been able to open things up in our community. The disease rate and prevalence has been low enough that our percentage of seriously ill hospitalized people and deaths has not been higher, although we would like the deaths to be zero. But the worry is, are we set up to get in trouble, you know, in October or some other time, and then reflect back and say, should we have done something different in August? You know, what risk is our community willing to accept going into the fall when we usually do see more illness? And if that risk, if we could not risk a doubling of our case rate, for example, if we could not risk deaths going up, hospitalizations going up, well, there's a 2 to 3 week lag out from that in terms of the intervention. So, you know, we need to be planning for that in a preventive mode.
Well, and I think, Dr. Harrington, to your point, I mean, maybe we could continue through the rest of the year status quo, but we're not looking at status quo. We're looking at schools reopening. We're looking
exactly
at happening. We're looking at flu season happening, you know, and so we do have to think about it differently because things are going to change.
Status quo assumes that the variables all remain constant. And as you're pointing out, we have some new variables coming into play that could change that equation.
Mm-hmm. So glass half full thing would say though that we made it through 4th of July and we made it through most of the summer tourism with our workers and the rest and trying to do what we can with the people that were on the front lines as well. So I appreciate the conversation here, but you know, I couldn't social distance anymore. I'd have to be in the barn. So.
Dougmonger is the model of social distancing.
There you go, man. They don't even
I have few peers when it comes to social distancing. So
I don't know. You're in your office, Tim. I haven't seen Doug out of his home office in months.
Can I compliment our community? I feel we have done well.
Mm-hmm.
I feared some things would be worse this summer as we get into the fall. But I don't believe that the factors are going to remain constant. We've got school, we've got the typical rise of illness as we get into colder weather and all that. So our assumptions may go off of that.
Right. Well, and I can certainly work with Robin. You know, I think of those fashion magazines, you know, who wore it best, you know, maybe get some images of people wearing masks, you know, properly and not having your nose hang out or, you know, that they actually have them on their face, you know, and who, you know, there's some creative masks out there too, you know, and maybe start getting some photos of people around town, kind of that, positive deviant, right? So we want to take pictures or highlight people doing it right and give them kudos. And, you know, maybe we can turn that into a campaign of sorts.
I think that all makes sense. My question is, in terms of behavior, it feels like, while it's not perfect, mask wearing might be among the behaviors that our community is doing best. You know, we've had such an emphasis on it for such a long time, and that it really is the social distancing and the gatherings right. that maybe need to be more of the focus. Wouldn't you think? I mean, I think the masks are the most photogenic part, right?
Right, but exactly. In terms
of behaviors, those are probably more the ones that need to be emphasized, I would think.
Yeah.
I kind of like that sports metaphor of the crunch time, and I'm thinking of things like, you know, don't huddle up, or you know, we're in the fourth quarter and we've got a chance to win. I don't know, but I'm a sports guy, so.
Well, that would satisfy all the people that have been missing football, I guess.
And you know what happens when we try to get into creating our own messages?
Yeah, again, I think. That's the professionals.
So, you know, we've refrained from trying to get involved in the school reopening, you know, trying to allow them to do their thing. And again, you know, I don't know. I'm hopefully in the crunch time as well, but at the same point in time there, I guess that is a community thing that we need to all be aware of. And then that's the changing of the game here when that is going to be happening. So I don't know what I'm not in asking for any more rules or regs or whatever we need to do, but I guess and Dr. Harrington, I know you've been working with them closely to work through some of those issues. And maybe it isn't, you know, I mean, I just scared, you know, thinking about, people riding on the buses and the rural people heading to town and the opening up 100% as well. So, I mean, it is frightful as the Board of Health as well. So,
yeah. And I, you know, people throughout the community schools, everybody wants to know what our number mark is when we do something hard, when we do something more. I've been hoping we would have clear marks from on high. I'll just say that I, you know, keep looking at the test positivity rate. I keep looking at the case rate for our county. I think if we hit those hard numbers, you know, I showed you earlier that if we got 18 cases in a week, that would be bad news. If our test positivity rate was above 5%, I would consider that bad news. Now we have to decide, do we act on 1 week of data? As we've discussed earlier, our small numbers can allow quite a bit of variation. So we have that consideration, but then we also have the consideration of you act before you get too far down the road with it. And then do we wait till we are exactly a test positivity rate of 5, or do we start talking about changes when it's 4.8? I would suspect that we start talking about things when it's, you know, lower than 5%, or when our case rate gets above 10 in a week. We're going to hear in these forums, we're going to have that conversation. But in terms of the hard point that we would feel obligated to do something, I still target that test positivity rate of 5%, and our daily average, or the week would be 18 cases for us, for example, in Route County. We got to think about that, and we could get to that point. I know people want that mark. They want to watch something on our webpage or something that says, oh, the number is this, therefore things are going to change. And so I understand that. And I think we've got a couple numbers to focus on, but there's going to be a lead up to that. And then we have to factor in this kind of 1 week deal. Are we going to act on 1 week of data? Are we going to wait 2 weeks? We have to collectively decide that.
One just comment on that, as far as the thresholds and the tipping points and that kind of thing, just thinking about some of the really good conversations we've been able to have in this work group that I'm on with the state. A lot of the conversation is, it's not just about case counts, it's also about capacity to do containment. And so it's just not as simple, I don't think, it's as simple as when we have X number of cases, we're done, right? Like this, we're closing restaurants, we're closing bars, we're closing whatever, you know. That idea of closing is, it's a way to prevent exponential growth, and it's a last case scenario. And so it's just, you know, I don't have any great answers, and that's kind of what the state, this group is trying to work through, but that it's not just about the raw numbers. It's also about how well contained the virus is within the community. And, you know, even Dr. Herlihy, who of course she's not the only epidemiologist in the world, but I think she's really smart and she understands this really well. You know, she said, we don't really know what that tipping point is where it's going to go to exponential growth. Like, we know when it's at exponential growth, we can tell, you know, we know when we're kind of, we're sneaking upward, but we don't really know what the, like, what's the hard line of when we have to do something now, or we're going to get to exponential growth. And then the other really important point she made, which I think circles back to our idea about these education efforts, is just that small changes make a really big difference. Small changes in behavior, in human behavior, can make a huge difference in the trajectory of the virus. And as a case in point on that, what she showed is, based on their models, the difference of 5% in social distancing is double the number of I'm not remembering if she used hospitalizations or deaths, but the difference between 50% social distancing and 55% social distancing, which as an individual, I may not even notice that difference, right? Am I interacting with people 55% of what I did pre-pandemic or 55%, you know? But that, just that difference, changes, and I'm not remembering correctly whether it's the hospitalizations or the deaths, but changes that number by half. It cuts it in half, if just that 5% difference. So I think that really underscores the value of having these kind of efforts around people making changes in their behavior, so that we don't have to get to those points of cutting things off. But then also, to your point, Dr. Harrington, that if we are approaching those thresholds that we're concerned about, then we absolutely would have to start acting at that point, not wait until we're kind of past it.
Yeah, I would say it's we're third and six, and we don't want to end up being fourth and 10, right?
I mean, Robin's page has the key listed right there. Socially distance, wear your mask, wash your hands. I mean, all the commitments to containment that we talk about. We have, in the last couple of weeks, perhaps been a little myopic on our vision of things. You know, we've had this focus on the data part, but throughout this, we've often commented about what's our capacity to deal with it. And it's important to remember that we've got good hospital capacity locally and in the state right now. PPE equipment, those are things that our recovery team continues to look at. So to that point, yes, there's a more sophisticated look at where we are with the disease and our ability to deal with it that is not explained adequately by one or two numbers.
And I don't know if this is an appropriate time to maybe tagging on to this discussion to potentially discuss the role of what a public health educator might be. Because a lot of the activities that we're talking about right now, yes, we've got Robin, who's amazing in terms of getting out PR and stories and articles But really, you know, for the long term as well, looking at public health, this is really the role of a public health educator, where they're out there educating the public about these tools, reminding people about these behaviors, and then, you know, kind of looking further down the line, this role would be helping with any of our maternal child health activities, with our any kind of youth violence, our fatality data, and education around that, you know, coalition building, networking, and that's really, you know, as you mentioned, Commissioner Melton, that's really a lot of the role of public health, is to get out these messages and to be a part of these conversations. And we've got the data piece that we're collecting data, but it's almost the person that goes out there to educate people on the data that we've found. So,
and I would just add to that, you know, that's a role that we've been trying to fulfill for public health, and you know, we're having trouble sustaining that with the resources that we have. And then I would also add that perhaps, and I talked to Mo about this, and I think there'll be more conversation on Friday about that person potentially assisting with that Protect Your Neighbor, some of those objectives. But like I said, you guys will talk about that on Friday.
All right, we are coming up close to the end of our time before we move to public comment. Commissioners, do you have any more questions or comments for public health?
But I did think that Scott was going to maybe also, just as part of this Board of Health meeting, talk a little bit about the air quality stuff. There is life outside of COVID in the public health world, and I thought we had said that there was a discussion about that.
No, that's fine. A good suggestion, Commissioner Melton. Scott, I've heard rumors that there's smoke in the air. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I got a text from Beth last night. It was holy smokes, which is true. I was saying earlier that there's only one other time that I can remember where it may have been this bad. It's when we had a lot of sources of smoke coming from the west on top of a fire locally. But it wasn't this prolonged. And at that point, we didn't have the ability, or a very good ability, to monitor what the conditions were locally. And so that kind of kicked off an effort towards getting some monitors up and running. And we found there's some relatively inexpensive monitors that we can use that aren't, you know, accurate scientifically, but give us a pretty good idea of what conditions are locally and how we should respond and the message we should be getting out. And I've spent quite a bit of time this morning conversing with the schools and other people, restaurant workers who are worried about working outside. And so, you know, what these monitors have done is kind of give us a good gauge of how we should respond. So currently we have a monitor here at the county. I noticed that somebody else in the public put up a monitor over near City Market. And I know that the college was planning on putting one up. We also have one that's running in Oak Creek and also a North Route. The reception is spotty up there, so that one kind of goes on and off. The one in Hayden is not working anymore, and so I'm working on getting another one put up over there. So, you know, based on those numbers and based on the air quality alerts and information that we get from the state, we can respond and give informed responses for levels of activity that are appropriate depending on physical condition and what the activity is. We also put some additional information on our website about activity levels, and I've been talking to Luke DeWolf quite a bit this morning. I think that we have a much better handle on it. It's unfortunate. I wish there was something we could do about it. But I think the best that we can do is try to keep people informed and be able to intelligently answer their questions.
Hey, Scott, how does the public access that data? It's publicly accessible, is it not? Those data coming from those monitors?
Yep, that's a great point. It's purpleair.com. And then you just go right to the map. And so that's accessible from anywhere where you can connect to the internet. And so I would encourage people to take a look at that, and you can track it. And, you know, based on the air quality in the region from other monitors, you can really kind of see where the smoke is coming from. Right now, it looks like it's a little bit worse to the south, but the air can change and blow that stuff up our way. So it could get worse. Hopefully it doesn't. But yeah, purpleair.com is where you can go and look at that information. And then I would also encourage folks who want more detail to go to the Colorado Division of Public Health and Environment Air Quality Alert page. There's some other links and more detailed information about public health and so forth.
So Scott, what's the current recommendation for outdoor activity in Rapid County?
I would say that those activities, you know, cardiovascular activities, I would discourage. Certainly, if you have a pre-existing health condition, I would try to limit exposure. I was just talking to Luke DeWolf about the golf team. Perhaps some light activities would be okay, and I would defer to Dr. Harrington also. I would also think that the masks that we're all wearing would also help block those particulates. So in a nutshell, I'd avoid those cardiovascular activities and try to limit your time outside if you can. Pay attention to that long-term exposure over multiple days. That's really what we're trying to avoid.
Yeah, and I'm going to kind of just toss this off to Roberta. As an industrial hygienist, air quality is one of the key things that she's spent a lot of her career working on. So I'll let Roberta kind of comment.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, our regular cloth masks may not be adequate for filtering the 2.5 PM, the particulate matter is what we're looking at. But those more filtering face pieces, you may have seen like the K95s or N95 respirators, those are more efficient at blocking out that particulate matter. With some of those, though, there are some nuances that you have to be fit tested for those to make them appropriate. But if you aren't able to get fit testing, you know, making sure that it has a nice seal around your face is really how that's going to work best. Because if you have any kind of loose ways for that air to continue to get in, you know, that definitely kind of defeats the purpose a little bit. But those filtering type face masks for this situation for our particulate matter that's out there can be effective. So, you know, we've got mandatory mask wearing. So I guess, you know, not only for COVID, but also for particulates. So
how about these surgical masks?
Yeah, they're not as good with that particulate matter. Again, it's not creating a good seal around your face, and that's, you know, what we want to see. It might have some benefit. It's better than nothing for sure, but really those filtering face pieces, that is really what they're intended to do, is really block out. You know, you'll see people that are working with silica or with other contaminants, dust, wearing those types of masks, a dust mask. And again, the better seal you can get, the better protection.
Yeah, and let's just highlight, we're talking about a different thing here from wearing masks to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Right. I mean, you know, we can't put a mask around this fire, unfortunately. But this topic is a different one. This is how, you know, I can put something over my mouth so I don't breathe in particulate matter. It's not that discussion about spraying things out. We are at a danger level in particulate matter, even for healthy people right now. Mm-hmm. We kind of passed the point where people with respiratory illnesses need to be careful. So to some degree, staying indoors, but limiting exertion outside. But our levels, even now, looking at the Purple Hat page, I mean, we're at the level now where even healthy people need to be careful about how much they're going to do outside, and they will experience symptoms. And unfortunately, this looks like it's going to go on for a while. The fire is getting bigger. They don't yet have ideas of containment yet. The prevailing wind patterns look like they're going to continue just directing us. So this might be with us for a while.
Well, and it might be interesting to see if our testing goes up, because a lot of the symptoms of breathing air that with particulate matter, you know, you could be getting a sore throat or stuffiness, and we're seeing that in some of our COVID symptoms as well. So, you know, that kind of will add to some of that confusion.
Great. So I would like to get to public comment here, but I want to make sure that everybody's had an opportunity to have their say before we do that.
That's all I had, Tim. Thank you.
You good, Doug? All right. Roberta, Brian? Great. Kendra, I see that we have quite a number of people on the line, and I already see one hand raised for public comment. But it would be helpful if you describe what folks need to do in order to make public comment.
Sure. So in order to do public comment, you would need to raise your hand. So if you're on the computer, you would use the raise your hand function down at the bottom. If you're on the phone, you would do *9. Keep in mind, if you're calling in on the phone, you do need to unmute yourself via your phone, and then also press *6 to unmute yourself through the Zoom function. So go ahead and raise your hands now, and then Tim will call on you in the order of hands raised to speak.
Or some other order that I see fit. I see that Dave has his hand raised. So Dave, if you would go ahead and identify yourself, please. And we are not hearing you, Dave.
Hello.
We can hear you.
Great. This is Dave Corey again. I left public comment last week, and I sent some emails the week before about getting the underlying data so that we can confirm the averages, which are produced from the underlying data and presented on your dashboard. And I was hoping that we would get that data today, and I'm really looking forward to it. And during public comment here, there's a few things that I got to bring to the table to mention. And that one thing is that Dr. Harrington at the pilot town hall stated clearly that Harvard site that hitting that threshold of 10 per 100,000 people would be an indicator that we would need to do something different. And that the adage of doing the same thing and repeatedly doing the same thing wasn't going to help us get rid of this. And I kind of look at that as picking the scab and not letting it go away. And that Harvard data before that was considered the gold standard in your Board of County Commissioners meetings. And now that threshold, that number did hit 10 for 2 days in the last week on that Harvard data, what I'm hearing in this meeting is that that's a mistake and that Harvard is wrong and that their math isn't correct. And I'm here to tell you that I've taken the Colorado, the data, the John Hopkins data, all the data, and I have verified the 7-day and 14-day rolling averages myself personally. And I can verify that on routecounty.net, a site that I took personal responsibility of taking whatever publicly available data that was available to me and putting it into charts that can be graphed on my own with the help of fact checkers. We've provided data that's reliable to this county. It's not right to come and show a formula without giving underlying data and then say that the gold standard Harvard is wrong right now. And I would hope that we can make a correction in the statements that were made today, and that Dr. Harrington and Roberta can go back and check their math because it's wrong. And I just have to make that known. And another few things that I have to say is, like, you know, I'm not pushing, and and just by being a fact person, and I've been people have insinuated that they think that I'm calling for shutdowns. and that I have a political motivation. I do not. I would like to get facts presented to the people, case data, metrics that don't move, graphs that are done right, and so that when they see an increased risk of a critical threshold maybe being met or something may need to be done differently moment, that they can understand that that is their personal responsibility to do so. Maybe they won't go to the grocery store this week. Maybe they won't go out to the mountain and play in the water with the kids this week because the data is accurate. It is the cure. Truth and science are the cure. And I keep hearing some other things being tossed around, like these small numbers, like, oh, we only have 5 cases. Oh, 2 cases isn't a big deal. How do we do this? We have to average it. But, you know, that is an indicator still. And it can't be disregarded when you have 1 case or 2 cases. That's still a percentage of your cases. And if I include them in the rolling averages, they all add up. But there's a few things that I'd like to say about the obfuscation of the data in our dashboard. And that's that we have had metrics hit that have turned indicators red. And then they turn away from red because you don't like the color. Because that indicator is there to say this is a threat. This is a metric, a variable that should remain constant, which is then altered to show a different trend. And that is wrong. It's saying, you know, if we take things like rolling averages also, like we are now, and we put them on a chart, we have incomplete data from August 1st to now, because people haven't got their tests back. Some of them haven't even been tested yet. And the state, CDPHE, says that if you are on rolling average data, you can't call reliable information after August 1st. That's not even mentioned here. And not only that, but we don't know when we look at the dashboard what metric you're using. If it's the data of report date, if it's the data of onset date, and each one of these that goes back further in time prolongs the speed and efficiency in which we can come up with metrics. And it's really important that we don't just listen and see a formula and not have some quality assurance. Please put somebody in charge of quality assurance. Because every time we do this, we undo it, we hear another excuse. We found some more cases this week. There's all this stuff. Nobody's looking back and saying, hey, how did you do? And what can we do to be better? And I think that this is something that I don't want to have to do as a community member. I don't want to be quality assurance for the county. And now it's become my personal responsibility. And thank you for my comments. I'll leave some time for some others.
Thank you, Dave. Is there anybody else that would care to make public comment? I'm not seeing any other hands raised. Going once, going twice, and I will now close public comment. Roberta and Dr. Harrington, thank you very much for coming today and giving us this update. And I'm sure we'll be talking to you again. Thank you.
Wash your hands.
Thank you. The next item on our agenda is an update from Mountain Architecture on the status of the Department of Human Services building. And I am going to, you guys can go ahead and start talking, but I'm unilaterally going to go take a quick break. I'll be right back.
He's unilaterally. I guess that means we're chairless right now. So,
well, I still have a chair over here. Just joking.
Hi, everyone.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. Did you
want us to get started or wait till he came back? That was pretty unclear.
Yeah, so we'll wait. He'll only be gone a minute. So we'll wait till that. I think that's good. Okay. We all want to hear the amazing work you guys have been doing, so that sounds good.
Yeah, we're excited to talk about it.
And we're happy to talk about something else other than COVID too, just so you know.
Yeah, well, it was really interesting to listen in for the last 15 minutes on the smoke and particulate level. So interesting for me.
The smoke is crazy. It's crazy. It's not as bad this morning, but I've never seen anything like this here. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, last night in Hayden, and I'm sure, well, when I was in Steamboat at 6 as well, yeah. And man, driving home, it was like, you might as well had your headlights on, and was just driving at night. So it was just absolutely, I've never seen anything like this as well either in my life here. This is just absolutely crazy the way the wind's blown it up and then blown it up here too and blown the fire up and then blowing. I saw a Facebook post last night, since we're waiting on Commissioner Corrigan. I saw a Facebook post last night showed, in fact, Cheryl Dalton with the county posted it, showed an airplane flying around the cloud and you couldn't see. I mean, the airplane was just a small little fragment and you could see the airplane, but it was only a small little fragment in the picture. And the rest was how big the cloud was. It was just incredible. Yeah, it's not a good deal. I just thank goodness that we haven't, knock on wood, we haven't had one here. Thank you. Just really appreciative of that. Whatever we could keep doing of that regard.
Yeah. I was just looking at the weather forecast as well, and it doesn't look like we have any moisture predicted. So,
Tim's
I'm
here.
Back.
Yep.
I'm back. Let's get to work.
Okay. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
So we met last week with, I've been calling it kind of like DHS and health leadership team to go over some proposed floor plans, our initial concepts there. Lacey, I think our echo is kind of, okay, all right. We've got an echo amongst our office here.
Those were sent. Have you all had a chance to take a brief look at what we've come up with, or? We had forwarded those, right, Chancy, last week?
Mm-hmm.
Or this will just be a new fun exercise.
Well, they're in our packet, so yeah.
Okay,
so
good.
Great, and we will, I'll share my screen here so we can kind of go over the concepts together. One big question that is will need to be answered hopefully today in order for us to keep proceeding is how and if we want to incorporate the public health facility into this floor plan. That's not something that we had accounted for to the extent that has been described to us, you know, in the last week. So that's going to be a big decision that I think we'll need some direction on. But I'll go ahead and share my screen here.
Can I just ask a question about that? We yes. have been planning on public health being in this building though. Right. We just have realized we have maybe some different needs than what we had originally talked about.
That's right, Beth. Yeah, we had initially been directed to account for about 3 offices and a small storage space with some refrigeration. And now we're looking at between a 2,500 and 3,000 square foot outpatient building is what's been described to us, which is a significant change of direction than what was originally kind of accounted for in that space.
So, Chance, would you repeat that? A what? A 2,500?
Yeah. You need to explain
what? Did you say outpatient building?
Yeah, that's what we talked about last week.
So I guess for my benefit, what exactly is an outpatient building?
That's a really good question and something I was hoping to kind of cover today. Roberta Smith, who it sounds like is doing a really great job and everybody seems really happy with her contribution, you know, at this time. She has some experience with outpatient facilities and apparently Mark Collins and Ray are looking for between a 2,500 square foot and 3,000 square foot building to rent to provide this function.
We're already beyond that point, so that may have been a building we were thinking about renting, but we are now accommodating public health inside of our existing facilities.
Okay.
So it really is, I think, just a question of what we all collectively think is an appropriate space, number of offices, and number of people that we will potentially need to accommodate in a new building. So.
Okay.
Can I ask I just ask a question? I mean, I don't think that the commissioners know what Mark and Ray told these folks about what's needed. So maybe they could just summarize that for us first before you guys try to explain to us what you did.
Right. Okay. So Mark and Ray, you have the floor.
So commissioners, we did have a very important conversation with not only Mountain Architecture, but also the design team. Kelly was a part of that. Of course, Roberta was also involved, and Ray. I guess, Chancey, I'm also a little confused. That was certainly a mistake, but that we were not referring to an outpatient clinic, but the focus was the enhanced square footage that we would need to accommodate public health, where, yes, we are looking for approximately 2,500 square feet based on some other facilities we looked at, but not in an outpatient clinic kind of format, but instead still following the profile of what we're even going to accommodate within the annex, which is a suite of offices for our key personnel, supply space, some clinical space, and those are the primary elements that we're looking at. So yes, there could be potential of immunizations may take place there. We may have some public health traffic that comes and goes, but I don't think that the technical term that I would utilize would not be an outpatient clinic. And I'll let Ray kind of chime in as well.
You pretty much covered it. While I guess depending on what you call it, but there was a clinical space in it. So whether it's outpatient clinic, whatever you want to call it, but Chancey is correct. Initially, we were talking three office spaces and some storage space. Now we're talking as many as eight office spaces and still a clinic space. And I was just looking, I don't see Roberta on here and I don't see her on the invitation. So I was going to give her a quick call to see if she wanted to join. Is Roberta on here? Because I think she is the best to really address this.
Well, let's not get too bogged down in this right now. I think one of the concepts that we've talked about quite a bit is flex space, because I think the disadvantage that we all have right at the moment is I don't think any of us can sit here and to say today what the exact needs of public health will be 2 years from now. We kind of know what their needs are today, and we are bumping up around 7-8 people, but that's not to say that need will be that great in 2023, say. So I don't know how that might help guide the conversation. I think it's certainly appropriate to think in terms of 2,500 square foot of space that may ultimately be needed by public health, but I'm not sure how much we should get hung up on the exact details of what that space would look like.
Yeah, and I would concur with that too. I think our last conversation, we kind of said, well, let's just build the site, whatever we can get on the site pretty well too. So I think that was a primary objective for me anyhow. So
yeah, I would suggest let's bring up the drawings, because what we've done to this point is specifically what the original intention was with our agreement, which is to start creating floor plans and a building that would accommodate human services and the three offices of public health, and what you will see is a certain number of occupants for that, a 12,000 square foot building is what we're illustrating. We haven't assigned spaces yet. Let's just start with the graphics of what we've provided. And at some point we will want to start assigning spaces, but it's more or less, we're looking for some critique of the personnel flow and association of the spaces inside. So I think Chancey, let's just start with if you could split the screen with the floor plan. Mm-hmm. And realizing we will have, to reconsider some of the assignments for public health, but we can do that as the plan develops.
I, just as an aside, we keep referring to this as the Human Services Building, but I think we need to just make sure that we're clear that this building is for Human Services and public health, and it's sort of an unfortunate oversight for public health to not be invited to this meeting. So I'd like to just request that we remedy that in the future.
Maybe we can have a new term.
Statement to the world. It's our Health and Human Services Building is really what it is. I don't know if that's the name we'll stick with, but it's not just a Human Services Building mm-hmm. at this point.
Okay. I hear you, Beth. We'll start referring to that amongst ourselves as the Health and Human Services Building as well. So I'm going to pull up the floor plans. Again, this is kind of our first blush. We're pretty excited about it. And like Ed said, we want to get into assigning spaces to different offices. We have kind of some pods assigned for different departments, if you will, within Health and Human Services. So we'll work with that leadership team to kind of assign things there, but I'll go over kind of quickly here just our general floor plan scheme. All right. Can everybody see my screen okay? Yes? Okay. I'll take that as a yes. So in this package that you received and on the screen here, you know, we have a few pages that you've looked at previously. Let's see if I can get my computer to. So the site plan that we reviewed initially, this is kind of an overall site concept, you know, with the L-shaped building that right now we have designated for Health and Human Services, and then still showing the potential for 3,000 square feet of some function that we can kind of get into later, whether that's childcare, that could potentially also be the 3,000 square foot that we keep hearing would be necessary for health. So options there to accommodate the Department of Human Services and their square footage needs in this L-shaped building and potentially move some of those, you know, shift things into this other footprint as well. So let's initially just kind of go through the floor plan for this L-shaped building, and then I think we can continue the conversation for what could potentially be in this other footprint. All right, so here's our color-coded floor plan. Oak Street at the top of the page and 6th Street over here on the side, as you're all very familiar with. Right now, the current DHS building sits on this area of the site, and the cabin is kind of over here in this zone. So what we've done is create an entrance that kind of addresses both Oak Street and 6th Street and communicates pretty well with the adjacent county buildings. So we'll kind of start there, the entrance, and then walk through the building with you. And Ed, Lacey, chime in at any point if you have something to add, or if anybody has any questions, please interrupt me. So we have an airlock function here as you enter the building with what we're envisioning as some covered outdoor space for outdoor waiting. You know, somebody needed to just have some space. I know we're all social distancing right now, so just trying to kind of accommodate some outdoor spaces. Entering through the airlock, this entire area is designated kind of as a waiting and circulation where you would be greeted by the receptionist. We also have a tech of the day space over here, which was a requirement that we heard loud and clear, and also just another admin space here. So walking in, greeted, some waiting over here. This could potentially be children's games, just kind of giving a few different areas for different parties to have a little bit of privacy. The orange shaded areas are vertical circulation, so we can have, you know, an attractive open wide stair here off of the main level that will take you directly up to offices above that would be directed. Moving further into this kind of wing, if you will, we have support in the form of restrooms over here that are accessible to the public without them having to walk through office spaces. And then this large kind of conference / training room that could seat up to, I think, about 40 people were the requirements that we had for this. And this area over here opens up to outdoor courtyards for kind of like an indoor-outdoor function. We also have a commercial kitchen attached to this, and a side entrance here for service to the kitchen, or if you did rent this out to a nonprofit for an event or something of that nature, they could walk right in this door and not kind of disrupt the functions that are happening over here. So we're really kind of liking how this room in particular relates to the site features of the creek, the open space, developing some courtyards, but still has that nice street presence and light and windows. We also plugged in a wellness area up here that could be a lactation room or just a place for somebody to take a personal call, rest, whatever function that kind of could serve as just a wellness space. So moving back down the page over here, we do have a staff entrance off of the back, assuming that staff parking would be accommodated off of the alley here. So private staff entrance here, as well as down here in the corner where staff can come in. Maybe there are lockers or functions of that nature in this area. But just these two entrances that are kind of more utilitarian function. As you move from this entry point through the building, we have three interview rooms of different sizes. When we met with leadership, we talked about potentially changing some of these interview and waiting spaces to meet their needs better, but right now we're accommodating three different sized interview rooms and some closed, you know, kind of traditional offices to support DHS down here, as well as kind of an open office and huddle space. A small break room, and then another private restroom for staff or whoever is using this interview room. We also have another kind of covered walkway here along this end of the building that fronts 6th Street, but could have some kind of signage to direct users to this back building, whether that's childcare or potentially so that this building and function back here doesn't get completely lost from the street perspective. So that's kind of the quick rundown of this main level floor plan. Does anyone have any comments so far, or should I go ahead and show the upstairs floor plan layout and then we can comment? Any preference? All right. We're gonna go upstairs and then we can kind of hash through this. So moving up. Again, these orange shaded areas are that vertical circulation pod with an elevator and the main stair. We also have, you know, a secondary exit stair in the back of the building down here. But as you come up to this level, we have, we're suggesting an open to below area so that we get volume in that main entry. And it doesn't feel quite as closed in and hallish, if you will. So vertical circulation here, again, the green areas are kind of utilitarian support in the form of restrooms, another little respite area, and an area here that hasn't necessarily been earmarked for any particular function, looking to Health and Human Services to kind of direct us on how they would like to use this additional space. Up here over that kind of larger community room and kitchen, we have what could be a single department shaded in purple. Again, with private offices, an area for huddles, some storage, and then an open office concept here as well. Moving down into this area of the building, again, we've kind of shaded some different areas for different departments, whether it's veterans or child services. We'll move through that, I think, next with leadership. But right now, we've just kind of noted that you could have one, you know, function here in this open office concept. We have a couple of different sized conference / huddle rooms shaded in pink, and then additional, you know, closed offices in the center here, traditional private offices with open offices surrounding those. And the idea with these private offices located in the center is that these open office spaces receive a lot of natural daylighting and ventilation and are a little bit more social and welcoming. And then these internal offices can have significant amount of glass and windows in them, so they get that light sharing capability. And they're also centrally located so that, you know, if this was a director, they could work with their staff pretty seamlessly and kind of have that view of what everybody's up to throughout the day. So what else do I need to comment on here?
I think the last thing I'll add is each space is kind of designed to be flexible. So right now we might be showing a huddle space or a larger conference area or an office. And these are all interchangeable. If an office needs to be where a huddle space is, that all works. So flexibility was one of our priorities with laying out this interior space. And I guess maybe the last thing I'll call out is we have an outdoor deck provided at the bottom, kind of off that egress stair, that offers views of Emerald and just outdoor space where staff could go work outside or take a Zoom call or whatever their future needs might be. So that's the plan as of now, and we know we have some additional items to consider with adjacencies and just some of the feedback, like Chancey mentioned, that leadership has shared.
I'm just going to add a little bit of technical information. What, now that you're a little bit familiar with the graphics of this floor plan, this represents around 12,000 square feet. It also represents probably around 30 to 32 workstations of employees. That does not count the conference areas and circulation, et cetera. But to give you an idea of what we are accommodating in the 12,000 square feet is approximately 30 people comfortably functioning in this building.
What's the staff of human services?
I'm sorry, Beth, I didn't catch that.
It's okay. What's the current staff number of human services? That's probably more a question for Julie and Kelly.
25, when we're fully staffed, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
And then, of course, so the what you've presented to us so far is exclusively human service function.
Not necessarily, because it's probably, you know, I'm going to say 30 to 32, but you can see that we are providing ample conference spaces that could easily be converted into office, for example. I'm not count for... all of these little conference areas are not included in that 30 to 32 people. So if it within this 12,000 square feet, we could easily start converting some of these conference or huddle areas into offices. This is just a starting point for us, and to give you a sense of the building capabilities. So we could probably, I'm gonna guess, eliminate some conference common spaces and get up to 40 people with private workstations, I would guess.
Mm-hmm. So Kelly, if we were just exclusively talking about human services here, and given what Ed just said in terms of being able to increase the number of folks working in this space, do you think this represents a 20-year fulfill the needs of human services for 20 years?
I think so. I think that when we did the estimate, we said about 12,000 square feet and up to 35 to 40 staff. I think the key thing is you know, if we want, which I do want, I'm very adamant that we should have public health there together. It's feeling, is there going to be a change in the workforce and the setup in 20 years where we can get by with less space because there's going to be more remote working, or but that's just one of those unknowns. But I mean, I like the layout. We could look at this the way it's set up is, like they said, we could always move around departments and units and things like that. And we'd be happy to share the space, but from the task for sure, we said about 12,000 square feet and 35 to 40, spaces. So, yes.
So you can envision the space as it is currently configured, accommodating 7 or 8 people from public health in the same area?
I think I would say yes. I think the difference is that would be that we're saying that we would only need about 10,000 to 9,000 square feet. So my worry is I think we can with the change in the workforce, but it if we put public health in there at 2,500 or 3,000 feet, that's only 10,000 square foot for DHS, and that's a different setup than originally. But I think with direction and with clarity, that may be okay because we have been able to work remotely. We do have positions that even before the pandemic were able to work in different locations. Child welfare workers in some counties always work remotely. So I just think if we wanted it to be traditional where we have a desk for all people in 20 years from now, it may be pretty tight going from 12,000 to 9,000 if we add public health.
Mm-hmm. So the floor plan coverage from the first floor to the second floor, we got those areas that are not being used, and is that
that's correct?
Why is that?
I would say about 7,000 on the first floor and a little over 5 on the second floor. There are some areas we could push into, some areas that we'd like to leave. For example, the open two-story space. Obviously, that's a value as far as we think, but that's why the square footages are slightly less upstairs than downstairs.
Well, I'm good with the open air and that, the light channeling down there. I'm just talking about to the east and to the west of the Oak Street side. Yeah, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so just to kind of comment again on the health public health department, I had kind of envisioned, with our original direction of them needing about 3 office spaces, some storage. That this purple area over here that's a little bit separate from the rest of the building would suffice for that. It sounds like that that need has grown significantly and they clearly need about 8 office spaces. So we can look at how to configure this area to better serve their needs.
That area can actually grow to the left too, where you see that all can become, that's just, let's say we reserve that for this conversation. That actually is a one-story section of the, so it could easily have expanding that two-story and obviously mm-hmm. add more offices if that was. So that's an example mm-hmm. of how the footprint can grow. We tried to keep at the 12,000 as a target, realizing now we can push the bubble a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Ed, do you think, I'm sure that part of your design here was also thinking about the appearance of the building from the outside. Do you think utilizing that space you just outlined, putting it up 2 stories, would that have a severe negative impact on the appearance?
Well, that's obviously the consciousness of what we're illustrating right now, and an attempt to keep that Oak Street facade, if you will, a little bit more residential scale. One of the things that I wanted to go back to in response to that, Chance, if you'd go back down to the first floor, we've stepped the building a little bit, maybe 3 feet in that area right where she's pointing to right now. That part of the building steps down a little bit because the natural grade steps down there. So the intention is to kind of bring that part of that Oak Street facade down a little bit. It actually starts accommodating the exterior grade a little better. But you're exactly right, Tim. One of the reasons not to move into that area of square footage is, are we okay with 12,000? This is an opportunity to keep a little more residential scale on an end of the building. But it is an area of potential square footage expansion.
Extending that area to 2 stories and losing some of that residential feel, would that in any way run afoul of the city's guidelines or goals?
We would still have to accommodate what the intentions are with residential in a different fashion, maybe moving the just different design. We're not there yet, but I understand the need to grow that square footage. we would have to address the city's concern with aesthetics and character in a different fashion.
So you already said, Ed, and Chancey, that pink section right there is already going to be half a story lower. So if you put a second story on it, it's going to be half a story lower than the different That's level.
It's actually about, we're guessing maybe 3 to 3.5 feet lower, but yes, that's part of the attempt. And also to meet what the natural grade is doing right there. It's starting to creep down, you know, once you get beyond the cabin, it slopes, and we would want to step the building slightly.
I would make this statement that going back to Commissioner Monger's original point about this building, which is to get as much square footage as we can without compromising totally the appearance of the building. We really get one bite at the apple, and I would think that we would want to be two stories in that place. I do understand that it makes for a different looking building, but it's the same thing we found out at the combined law enforcement facility. That's how we built our comm center, was by taking a space that was originally one story and just saying, hey, we're going to make it two stories. And the additional cost for that was well worth the compromise.
So I just ran a quick square footage calc on my end over here. If we do build out this area over the conference room, and just for conversation's sake, say this purple pod is public health, that ends up being just under 2,000 square feet if we include that space, this kind of area that I'm circling right now. We can rearrange. We could grab this green space that doesn't have a specific function right now and probably get closer to, you know, 2,300 by incorporating that. So we're getting close to your 2,500 to 3,000 square foot public health goal, square footage.
You know, I guess comment, I really like the alley side, even though it's on the alley, that south facing side there, and having that deck up there on top, I think it's going to be absolutely superb. And so that's a good thing. And I think the intersection of Oak and Sixth Street there, that open section there. And you've built in quite a few corners. I know those corners all cost money. So you've built in quite a few corners to kind of modify the bulk and scheme of it. I kind of like that concept as well too, but.
So,
commissioners, go ahead.
So I think what, and we haven't heard from Beth on this yet, but I
That's
feel
you like, guys keep talking. It's okay. Go ahead.
I feel like we're getting pretty close to providing direction to Mountain Architecture to extend that section to two stories. What is it? We're talking about roughly, what's that additional space, Chancey? Is that about 1,000 square feet or 800 square feet?
You can get that really quickly here.
Tim, I'm great with that. I was just going to say that Roberta is here now. So if you, we wanted her to weigh in on the public health space at all.
Yeah, we will in a minute, but I feel like this is a more basic question. Even if we were not trying to accommodate public health within this new building, I feel like Doug and I, at least, and maybe you as well, Beth, would be saying, hey, let's build out as much square footage as we can here. And what is that?
I agree with you. I think there's no question that we are tight on space, and we are going to continue to be tight on space. And when we have the opportunity to build, we should maximize that opportunity.
Chancey, what was that square footage, roughly?
So if we, to include this area over the conference room below and this green area, that ended up at 2,300 square feet. We also have this rectangular area here that we could capitalize on, which adds another 200 square feet. So we're getting really close to that 3,000 square foot mark.
I'm actually just more interested in that spot on the left, the gray slashed area. How big is just that? Yeah, how big is that square?
That is, 720 square feet.
So if we're thinking approximately $400 a square foot, that's another $300,000 extra that we would likely spend to add that square footage, just to put a number to it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I continue to believe, and again, I mean, Doug was the one that said this from day one, we get one bite at the apple here, and we should be maximizing the square footage in ways that don't compromise the function and appearance of the building. And that little 700 and some odd square foot space seems like a really good choice.
I agree. You already have the foundation there. We're already accounting for a roof, so we're really just adding some walls, floors, and partitions. And I think that we can still bring the building down architecturally, you know, with some kind of element or feature along the front of this building to accommodate the architectural guidelines for Oak Street. So I support the architectural side of adding square footage here.
Does that do anything to the ceiling height of the conference room below?
So I think we would want this area, if we claim this, I think we would want that to be the same floor level as everything else on the second level. So the ceiling and the area below would still have an additional 3 to 4 feet compared to the rest of the spaces. If you kind of follow what I'm saying.
In the conference room, we might have an 11 foot or a 12 foot
ceiling. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah. We also talked last week about, I'm going to go back to the main floor here, and Kelly has been so flexible with the layout of the space. It's been really great. But there's also kind of this purplish area and the green area. If we wanted public health to maybe just claim this end of the building, and DHS ends up with, you know, maybe a little office up here and the entire upper level. This area is, what did I have, is 2,500 square feet. So if that works for public health and is better for them to be on the ground floor, again, we're just planning to work with the leadership team to see who wants to claim what spaces and how we proceed to lay those out.
I have a couple of quick questions. Number one, Kelly and Roberta, the shared entry makes sense. Is that true?
Yeah, I think we'd want to share receptionists, I would think.
Okay.
Right, because we would have people checking in for appointments. So we would definitely need some kind of check-in point. And I think that logistically might be easier, you know, if it's on the first floor. I don't know. As long as wayfinding is clear, you know.
But sharing that entry doesn't present a big problem.
No.
And then my second question is public health, is there a big difference to public health whether they're on the lower level or on the upper level?
In my mind, it's no difference. You know, we would just need the clinic space. So I don't know with plumbing and all of that, if that's an issue, you know, where all that is situated, you know, we would certainly have to throw that in here in the design to look at how that clinic space would be best set up in the scenario.
So does the clinic space, you know, I know when we were looking at renting buildings, I kind of felt like there was the thought that it would be nice for the clinic space to have its own little private entrance and exit without having to go through any common parts of the building.
Well, we would need to have them check in, you know, and maybe wait in a waiting room. So it doesn't necessarily have to be totally discreet that way. And you know, I think just having the ability to have a flow from that front back to a clinic and having waiting areas that they, if, you know, where we have someone there already would be good.
Well, and you obviously, I have to assume you don't want, you want like some public parts of the building and parts that are not public, and you don't want people traipsing through the not public areas to get to the public areas.
Right.
Yeah, that was one of my questions too, is security. I mean, you guys, and Ray's been working with you guys and Mark, the team. So we're looking forward to, I mean, we're also discussing and keeping security on our mind here.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have taken that into account with this layout. We know that the layout is going to change, obviously, with the expansion of public health. But with this layout, you know, we have the interview rooms adjacent to the entrance, so that the public comes in, they come into the interview rooms without having to walk through these private offices. So as we rearrange the spaces, we'll continue to keep those types of things in mind. And also, you know, just having secure doors in strategic locations. So it's definitely on the forefront of our design mind here. And we have been working with Ray and getting his feedback on those items.
So one of the other questions I had was access out of or onto the second floor from outside. Is that not going to be, or I mean, so what's, where's the fire escape, and what do you do? Shimmy down a pole, or what are we doing with it?
We can add a pole if you'd like, but.
That might be sexy. I don't want to deal with it.
But we have these two internal exit stairs.
Okay.
The discharge right out onto the public ways here. So we've got that covered. I don't know that you want an exterior stair necessarily, like off of that deck. It sounds like that's been a little bit of a an issue with the current configuration. Julie had mentioned, you know, sometimes the Old Town pub patrons find their way up to that upper level deck and leave treasure. So
yeah, I'd like to back up a little bit to the issue on security and the one entry for the all functions. Bear in mind also, we are intending one point of entry, one point of security, but this is a two-story lobby where you, if the waiting area seems a little bit small, it actually, I would anticipate you're directed to go upstairs to a second waiting area also, as far as accommodating, whether it be public health or human services or whatever, but it the waiting area is really a place to be directed to another waiting area, if you will. So it's kind of a built-in economics of the efficiency of the floor plan a little bit. So I just wanted to stress that I think we are able to better control with the single entry and address that and give people direction once inside. So.
Yeah, that seems like a no-brainer that a single point of entry would certainly be less expensive from a security standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had a question for Kelly probably. So open offices, again, I don't know if you have open offices now or that's, you know, and again, we're in COVID world now, so that's all weirded out, but anyhow.
We have a couple of our units, like child support, kind of has an open office concept right now. Just with the way the building is remodeled, most people have their own offices, which are old rooms, which isn't really practical or needed. So we can definitely work with that.
Okay.
Yeah, because in terms of confidentiality, you're not worried too much about confidentiality between employees. It's just when you have clients come in the building, those conversations need to be confidential.
Right, and that's why we meet with clients in one of the interview rooms in the front, and then all DHS staff, you know, everything kept within DHS is confidential, and we all do a really good job of making sure when we're in the building that we're not using people's full names when we're talking to other departments, so we can adjust to that for sure.
And then I know that that's been a big challenge in the existing building has been those small conference rooms to talk with clients. So with this design as it is here, and again, this has not included public health, but this does provide enough of those kinds of private consultation rooms.
Absolutely. And we like the layout where right by the waiting room, they can just walk right in and have that conversation.
In the open office space, are we talking about like cubicle style, or are we talking about like a bunch of like Silicon Valley style?
I would say more like the Silicon Valley style. We have some images in this PDF that kind of portray open office concepts and just the many avenues that you can take the design. So it's not this sterile cubicle land like the movie Office Space. It's more collaborative, different types of seating arrangements, different desk styles, different working stations. So people can kind of tailor their specific needs. So that's, these are kind of the concepts that we're trying to build into the plan now.
Mm-hmm. And this is what and this is what Human Services wants. This is not a compromise to squeeze everybody into this space.
No, we heard, we did hear initially that a balance of open office space and private office space was desired. And so, you know, this is our first blush at a floor plan. And I think as we meet again with that leadership team and kind of refine the spaces, we can modify some of the open office spaces to be private if that's the direction they want to go, or keep those open office spaces. And again, kind of build in nooks for staff that is maybe predominantly in the field, but needs to come in and just kind of write up a couple of reports and just have a space to kind of come and plug in at the end of the day. Or you know, one day a week or however they function, without needing that dedicated private office space. So again, working with leadership to get what they want and they think is most functional. Yeah, flexible office space. And we do understand that COVID and this pandemic has brought a new conversation to the table about open office concepts in general. So we're trying to work through that as best we can with the current information we have.
But I think what something you just said is really important, which is just there's flexibility here and designing something where it, even if right now we know what we want in the future there, it's not nothing, but it's not as significant to make some of those kind of simple changes. You know, you could put up a couple walls if you decided open office wasn't working anymore or whatever else.
Yeah, and one thing that Roberta pointed out when we met last week that I thought was really valid was the fact that, you know, even though we do have these open office spaces right now, when you throw up a wall in the middle of it to create three private offices, for example, in this lower corner, we do need to consider what that does to mechanical systems. Again, not a big deal, and something that if we know in the back of our minds that this could change to be private offices in the future, you know, just keeping that that flexibility and space for future.
Yeah, actually, that kind of segues into a question. Have you, you may not have thought that far into the future on the design of the building, but certainly with these open office plans, there's a lot to be said for exposed structure rather than lowered ceilings, or mm-hmm. have you even gotten to the point of thinking about where you would have lowered ceilings and where you would have exposed structure?
We are thinking three-dimensionally for sure, and accommodating some probably dropped ceiling areas to accommodate those mechanical systems in certain areas. We don't have the answer defined okay. for that yet, but yeah, thinking about it. We're accommodating for that floor-to-floor space in order to get all of your mechanical equipment throughout the building.
What is the floor-to-floor space? Is it 12 feet?
We're thinking right now about between a 9 and a 10-foot ceiling on this level, and then probably a 2-foot structure and mechanical plenum before you get to that that upper level.
So and, roughly 12 foot.
Yeah, about 12 feet. And then also, Tim, just since we're on the conversation of mechanical equipment, we are thinking that we'll have a basement area where mechanical could be kind of more centrally located to the building in this back area. And then also this front could be just storage of extra furniture, whatever kind of storage needs we need to accommodate. So with that being said, you know, this basement area could grow if it needed to, if everyone was feeling they needed additional storage, but planning on a small basement area.
And so this is all gonna be a flat roof, obviously, and then, RTUs on top for the MCAP, for the air handling?
More than likely, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so.
Well, we opened this conversation with you all mentioning an outpatient space and us saying, hold on, that's not what we thought. And I mean, do we want to just take a minute to get clarification on that since we have Roberta here?
Sure.
Or maybe she popped off. I don't know.
I would love to.
I believe the last time, if Roberta has left, she had indicated there's some programming information that she had available that would help us more specifically plan the spaces for public health. We'd like to get our hands on that if that's available. Anything as we develop the design. And from that, I would imagine we would get a little more specific with the outpatient criteria.
My guess is that there's some confusion between the terms outpatient and clinical, but Roberta's probably the only one that can answer that.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding has been we're not really looking for a place that, I mean, outpatient, I think of like exam rooms and some of those kinds of things. I think it's literally just a space to like administer vaccines. I think that's the extent of the medical kind of side of what's going on. But Roberta obviously is the one to provide that clarification.
And she also mentioned some very specific equipment needs, like eye washing stations. And I think that kind of ties into her plumbing.
Got it.
Request. So yeah, I think if we define that more with her, that will help guide us.
Yeah, we're not going to be culturing bioterror weapons back in here, I don't think. So.
But I do think, I mean, there are, I guess to that point, there are kind of test types. I don't know, she knows, but it's, when you say outpatient, I picture a doctor's office, and I don't think that's what we're looking at here.
At the end of the day, it's just what you're going to put into that square footage. Mm-hmm. So, you know, call the rooms what you want to, but they're going to get squeezed into that roughly 2,500 square foot space.
Yeah, but we really do. I wish that Roberta was still on because we really could use some direction on, I did hear her use the word outpatient, so I want some clarification on that because there are definitely guidelines from the state and probably federal guidelines as well on those types of facilities that we need to familiarize ourselves with. So maybe I can follow up with an email to her and get a little bit more specific on what she's thinking for that, just to keep the ball rolling on our end schedule-wise.
I think the big question that probably needs to be answered, and I don't think I heard it really answered, is does it make more sense for public health to be on the ground floor and potentially have one other exterior entrance and exit that is not coming through the common area?
Mm-hmm. Which we could accommodate that on this end of the building. You know, if this is all designated health, we could put another entrance, you know, down here that's labeled differently. And then they also would have direct access to this lower level for storage of vaccines and things like that don't, you know, that could belong in a basement, if you will. So again, we'll work with that team to see who wants what space. One other thing that I just want to bring up to you all, because we're here looking at this plan, is that it sounds like we can probably accommodate both public health and DHS in this L-shaped building. We do still have a footprint over here that is 3,000 square feet. Not sure if it's worth entertaining the idea that the ground floor over here could be childcare and we could accommodate public health above in their own type of facility. Just kind of food for thought as we
on that point, I think we should go back to, you know, Doug's concept about maximizing the square footage on this space, on this site. And you know, what's kind of the upper limit of that we want to pursue? Because if we have 3,000 more square feet of office space we could put in, I think we should talk about if any of that should be built out just for future use, regardless of whether it's for public health or not. And I don't know the answer to that question, but you know, we don't have anywhere else to build downtown, right? So. Mm-hmm. If we're thinking about future needs, we should be thinking about those things.
Chancy, what's that footprint?
That's the 3,000 square feet that we had kind of earmarked for childcare. And if you, as you are aware, childcare needs to be on a ground level, but public health could potentially be on the second floor of this, and that would still, you know, maintain this 12,000 square foot footprint that was projected for human services. So,
Building a two-story building there rather than a one-story building is that's doable. I mean, does it dramatically affect the windows on the L-shaped building or the feel of the property?
You know, Tim, we've always, I think we've kind of gone in the direction that that 3,000 square foot footprint would be a phased project. What Chancey's saying, that potentially 6,000 square feet is there. There are obviously other issues that come up when and if that gets developed. One is parking, because you're adding square footage, you're needing to provide more parking because of that square footage. So to consider that as part of this project, I don't know. But the potential is there.
We need to kick that can down the road and kick that can down the road and for right now anyhow. I appreciate the L-shaped building and how we're defining it myself. So
that was our focus, but yeah. But bear in mind,
what are we kicking down the road?
The 3,000 square foot, the child care center, and the potential for a second story on it.
But the one thing you don't want to kick down the road is whether or not you are going to be building something on that 3,000 square foot as part of this one construction project. I think we've talked about that the idea of coming back 5 years from now and building a 3,000 square foot one story or 6,000 square foot two story building is going to be far more expensive to do it then than it would be to build it now with all the associated infrastructure.
So I question that by myself. So why wouldn't we just build the L-shaped building right now, make sure that we have the tie-ins for water and sewer and the rest. And so we have a self-standing structure that's not hooked up to the L-shaped building. So I mean, you guys, you architects, tell us what we're doing here.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear what they have to say about that.
I think as long as we can meet the immediate needs and we have planned for some expansion, the L-shaped building is meeting your immediate needs. We would like to go forward with that. Bear in mind that also then that you just in the back of your mind know you have potential to expand on this site at some point. I would rather not invent a building for potential use, not knowing its specific function at this point. I think we're trying to meet the immediate needs as long as we can accommodate all departments within the 12 to 13,000 square foot L-shaped building. It is, I think, a very appropriate use, especially when you consider what it offers for outdoor spaces. So that's my opinion.
As far as infrastructure goes, I think the location of this footprint on the site lends itself to easily tap into utilities that are located in the alley, as well as anything located in, you know, probably Oak Street. We can still kind of get some utilities tapped in over there. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. I think you're absolutely right that it would be less expensive to do it all at once. But as Ed said, if we don't know what that function is going to be, it's pretty difficult to design a building, just for the sake of having
it. The counter argument would be if by some miracle we had an operator of a childcare facility that knew that they really could use and somehow financially support this additional 3,000 square foot building. We would not want to pass up the opportunity to if we could afford it, if it made sense to create a childcare facility on that location right now. I think the challenge is that that's probably going to take quite some time for us to identify that operator and get firm financial commitments from any partners that might want to be a part of that.
Well, and as we talked about, there's a level of analysis that needs to be done in terms of the childcare facility. I think we should proceed with that analysis and figuring out whether it makes sense, et cetera. And, you know, I'm not particularly interested in thinking about that facility as something we might or might not do in 5 or 10 years. I mean, I think of it as part of this project. And so I think if we're going to do it, we need to determine whether we're going to do it or not. And I do, like I said, I think there is a full analysis that needs to be done. But I think what you guys are talking about, proceeding with the L-shaped building, knowing that we have a conceptual design that we could accommodate that there, is probably sufficient for now. And the analysis in terms of that 3,000 square foot site is really on our end. And we need to determine whether that's something we would proceed with now, or just know that it's there for whatever future use might happen.
So the direction, so let me take a crack at giving direction and then you guys tell me what's wrong with it. So we're to direct Mountain Architecture to proceed with the design of the of a 12,000 square foot plus 7,800, whatever we identified as the bumping out the second floor, and to make that design accommodate human services and public health. And we're not going to consider putting public health in that other 3,000 square foot footprint. We want public health to be in the HHS building. Is that correct?
Yes. Yep.
That would be good direction. I appreciate that.
That sounds great. Yes, agreed.
All right.
I only have one further comment a little bit. It's the utilization of all the whole thing. So on the corner of Oak Street and Sixth, right there up on the second floor, if you go up the second floor. So, you know, again, we do have 180 days of summer. So I hope that we could figure out how, you know, I like it being open, and especially if we have open to below. And, you know, and I appreciate natural sunlight and, you know, and how we can get that into the office buildings as well. So I don't know how you can figure out, you know, if we can have a part of a deck up there with fencing or something too. I can't believe it. Yeah. So, I mean, that would be great. If I was working over there, I'd be wanting to spend time on either one of those deck sides and during lunch break or whatever. So
when are we building ourselves a deck off of the commissioner's offices?
We'll put it over there on the Lincoln side right there.
Yeah, sounds good.
So Doug, you're not suggesting that space in the upper right hand corner that we're looking at right now be incorporated into inside square footage?
No, it wasn't inside square footage.
I think having a roof deck there, though. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. I mean, I struggled when we built the CLEF and we had that second story. We built the comm center up there, but we had a whole bunch of area that we just left just not nothing. So I don't know, you know, could have been usable space.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm all in. You can always be here. Right.
There you go.
Even more good direction.
Yeah.
So, it sounds to me like you've got some solid direction to work with. Obviously, you have to meet with the leadership teams to make sure that you get all the details taken care of. And I'm not sure how much the commissioners really care all that much how you configure this space, just so long as you're taking care of human services and public health. What are next steps look like for you guys and for us?
Yeah, so our next steps will be to again, kind of connect with leadership and have them claim spaces for departments and functions. We'll work with Roberta and Kelly and Julie on that to see who wants to be where, as well as developing this pod that we discussed over here. And I have
I have a few notes from today, but they're not too extensive. So we'll take these, incorporate them into the building, and then we'll come back to you in, I believe, 2 weeks is our next update, and hopefully have something that is going to work for both health and human services. So dialing in the floor plans, we'll run those by you, and we'll also start looking at exteriors as we move through the next, you know, 3-4 weeks of progress here.
So when will we begin to see some elevations?
I believe, I should pull up the schedule. I believe we will start to look at those within the month, probably towards the middle of September, we'll start to see something.
I think one more round of plans, and
yeah,
I'm comfortable saying we'll have nailed it down where the following meeting, middle of September, is time to start seeing some images.
Yeah.
Yeah, great.
We're excited.
Yeah.
So one thing I think we need to make sure we get with Roberta and get analyzed is this clinical space or whatever that is. And so make sure we're all on the same page there. So, and it's unfair that she had to skip out on us, but anyhow, so busy girl. Yeah.
We'll get her back in.
Yeah. She's busy right now. Got a few things to do, a lot of things on her plate. All right, well, thank you. I appreciate the time and the feedback. This was helpful. Yeah, thank you.
Great, thank you guys. Appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you, Matt. All right.
Okay, anything else, commissioners, or have we done our work for the day?
I'm good.
Mark?
I have more work to do today, but.
Mark?
Commissioners, and I know you've been hard at it here today. We don't want to prolong too much more conversation, but based upon the interviews that we've conducted over the last 24 hours for the epidemiologist position, we seem to have a direction, especially from Roberta's vantage point, where we would like to go ahead and pursue the idea of having a part-time epidemiologist that's going to do some of the very, very important data management that we've talked about today. And one of our interviewees is available to do that, that's got some extraordinary expertise in that area. Having stated that, we have another candidate that might be interested in the full-time position. So what we're essentially doing, and Beth outlined this in her email to you, what we're essentially saying is we'd like to hire a full-time epidemiologist as we know it. And then for the near term, what I'll call the near term, we would like to pursue the idea of somebody along the lines of 20 to 25 hours to help us with the data management as we get that up and running and we get that at the levels that we wanna do. So we would need to get the green light and the permission from the commissioners to move in that direction, if you're comfortable. And that's my question that I'd pose to you this afternoon.
So you're talking about hiring 1.5 FTEs instead of one?
Essentially, yes, Tim.
But I think with the shorter term person, it would either be on a contract basis or as a temporary employee, right? So not a benefited kind of a situation.
That's correct. So we say, Tim's exactly right, 1.5, but that 0.5 may be as short a window as 6 to 9 months.
Yeah, I'm good with that. I appreciated Commissioner Melton's email and analyzing. That sounds like a good plan. And again, I guess we know that we're still trying to figure that out since we didn't have any help from the state on figuring out how to do all of that, all those number keeping and the rest. So
I think it's a good, as I indicated to you guys in my email this morning, I think it's actually potentially even a better path forward, because I think that the really high level of expertise around epidemiology is honestly not going to be a long-term need for us. It's a short-term need. And so I think this is the perfect way to strike this balance between what we need in the short term and what our needs are going to be in the long term for public health. So, but I already pretty much told you guys that. So
I agree with that. Yeah.
Beth stated it extremely well, and I, you know, it's one of those things that we wind up in fortuitous circumstances. We wound up with somebody like Roberta who has extraordinary skills that, in fact, as we just went through some of the description of the HHS building, Roberta has phenomenal expertise in the industrial hygiene area, HVAC systems and so forth. So she's already adding to that very important expertise going forward. But she also mentioned to you this morning, commissioners, about the health educator position and how she sees that as a little bit different as we had first discussed it. And I think she expressed some really good outlines of what that would be going forward. So that would be another question to you, commissioners, whether we have not authorized that position as yet. As you know, it's been on hold, whether you feel like you would like to move forward and that we would begin a recruitment process or solidify a recruitment process for the health educator. So that's the second question to the commissioners today.
So I thought we were going to talk about that on Friday or something. Is that what I heard or something? Because I still need some more conversation. And I guess, you know, and I appreciate Scott's comment, you know, and I understand the need. I haven't figured out whether this is a short-term need or a long-term need, how we're going to figure out the, you know, if it's a long-term need, we got to figure out the funding for it as well. Yeah. So I don't know. And I guess so I need some help here yet.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the gorilla in the room is that we're gearing up with a, whatever it is, a 7, 8, 9 person department that in past years, we've only had about $200,000 a year to support. And the only way we can support a 7, 8, 9 person department is with the CARES funding that we currently have. So, you know, I'm getting pretty nervous about what the 2021 budget looks like with a, you know, if we're talking 7, 8, 9 people and all the resources, we're jumping from a couple $100,000 a year into $1 million a year of ongoing cost.
So my comments would be a couple of things. I think first is that I feel pretty clear that we need a good recommendation from Roberta about what the short-term and long-term needs of the department are. And philosophically, I'm supportive of her as the professional determining what that is and making a recommendation to us. And so to Doug's point, you know, just understanding what exactly is it that you see the health educator doing, what does that look like? So I think if she feels ready to bring forward that kind of information, she should do it and we should evaluate it. I think to Tim, to your point, I'm not sure that we're quite at 7. I mean, I'm thinking we have a nurse, a director, an admin, the epidemiologist, and a health educator, right? I count 5.
Plus the contract nurses.
But the contract nurses are not long term. I mean, they're there for COVID purposes, as far as I understand it. And same with the contact tracers. I'm just thinking about long-term, you know, sort of permanent positions.
It may not be as big a nut to crack as what I
Yeah, think. Exactly. I think we're talking about 5. And if Roberta really feels like that's what's going to make the department sustainable to do the public health work into the future, then I think she just needs to clearly articulate that for us. And then just on the contract side of things, you're right, Tim, that the county has been putting in that amount of money, the $150,000 or $200,000 a year or whatever it was. But it's the CDPHE contracts that we really need to have discussion about when it comes to funding, because a percentage of those contracts through Northwest Colorado Health has always been used to support the public health director position. When I've looked at those grants and contracts, they say, you know, 10% of this contract or whatever it is going directly into the director's salary or directly into this health educator's salary. So those contracts are where the money is. And
so the gap that I'm worried about is not as big as what I just described.
I don't think it is. There's just an analysis needed to make sure that we're not significantly increasing our general fund cost. And I think Roberta's the right person to do that analysis. I'm just trying to kind of reassure you about why I'm not as concerned about the dollars. I'm not interested in us just, you know, multiplying the budget of this department times 10 without any additional revenues. But I do think that there is money that we are not tapping into right now.
And I'm all good with that if that was to happen. I mean, yeah. You know, $220,000 was what we've been investing in public health. Good. We've been getting a hell of a deal. Now we look back and see we've been getting a hell of a deal. So, and again, we can't times that times five or, you know, some, in, you know, within. So I'm good and come up with the, you know, overall plan. And back to the health educator, you know, again, I guess I'm wondering still yet. And then I still think we're going to need the contract nurses just to have contract nurses available for another pandemic if we have one. But
well, we only pay for those when we use them. If you remember, a year ago or whatever, we signed that contract with them, yeah. and now we can call them for nurses when we need them. So I agree with you.
Yeah, pandemic at a time, guys. One pandemic at a time.
My only question back on the health educator is to validate, you know, the skills needed and whether that is better to have another nurse, you know, on staff that does the public health education as well. So I'm good. And I agree with you, Beth, that we need to have, you know, a long-term plan and, you know, come up with and that's what I think I have been able to get a grasp on is a long-term plan.
Yeah, I would just summarize, Mark, that I think it sounds like we're open to having the conversation. We just need a good sort of lay of the land of all of this. You know, what are the revenues? What are the positions? What are those people going to do after COVID's over? And make sure that we understand what's being asked.
You bet, commissioners. Thank you for this conversation. It's been extremely helpful, giving us good feedback so that we can provide that outline to you. What are the positions, short term, near term, long term, and have that all outlined for you with some associated budget numbers and that would associate with all of that. So my takeaway from our conversation is you're going to hear more about the health educator specifically this coming Friday, more of a conversation to give you a little better understanding of where we might head. We are going to provide this outline to you that gives you more of the short term, long-term outline of not only staffing, but also some of the budgeting parameters. And then lastly, we will proceed with commissioner's permission to pursue the 1.5 epidemiologist proposal, knowing that the 0.5 is going to be more of a short-term basis.
Yeah, so the 1.5 now, I'm good with the 1.5 figuring out based on conversation right now. So
way to take all our gobbledygook and turn it into something that's can go forward.
It's not that I've ever worked in a sausage factory, but you know, you've heard that expression about, you know, hey, on the floors of Congress, we're making sausage.
Great. Well, speaking of sausage, I'm ready for lunch. Is there anything else that we need to talk about?
I'm great.
Great. We will see you all tomorrow.
Yep. Thank you.